hour in the spirit, everyone. Just about 9:13 on WGN. It's John Hanson in for Dean Richards. We'll take it till 1 o'clock today. 312-981-7200 is our phone number if you want to jump in on any of the stuff we'll be chatting about today. Got some interesting guests lined on up. Well, Blockbuster Blake Stubbs will join us a little bit later. He's going to be part of our Dean's A-List interview. We'll talk about the new Superman movie. Oh, and at 12 o'clock, our good friend Bob Bertog, you hear him often when, I think it's Wednesdays or Thursdays, I forget which day. I think it's Wednesdays with John Williams, where he takes so many calls from you about your landscaping or gardening questions. He'll be here for a half hour, and we'll talk about his event coming up next weekend with Lou Manfredini as well. I'm going to do a little recipe. I'm no Dean Richards, but I've got a couple things that I've got cooking that I can help you out with at 12:30, just some ideas I've got. And we'll check in on a really cool local play that's being put on in Riverside. And I did a story once in TV World when I used to work more in TV about the town of Riverside and its unique history. And we'll play a little of that, and we'll learn about what they're doing in the community theater aspect over in Riverside and the southwest suburbs. But at 9:14, Dave Schwann, we already got someone that wants to stump the Schwann and John. So you ready to take our first phone call?
Well, let's give it a whirl here.
Ron, yeah. Ron from Westchester. How you doing, Ron?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Ron, going to stump the Schwann and John. Okay, that's a lot of rhyming there. Ron, are you a big presidential historian nut, too?
I am indeed.
Uh-oh. Well, now I'm worried.
So am I.
Okay, Ron, what do you got for us?
Who was the only president that, when he died, was not a citizen of the United States?
Ooh. Okay, Schwanny, let's talk through it, buddy. We must be going early days, right?
What, you want clues?
No, I don't want clues. I'm talking to Schwann, Ron.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I know all of our names sound the same except for Andy. But Ron, hold on. It's Schwann and John time. Okay. Schwann, any thoughts?
Not a citizen of the U.S. when he died.
Okay, so Washington had to be. Adams was. Yeah. Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Quincy Adams. I mean, he did a lot of traveling. Jackson, Van Buren. Harrison died quickly. Taylor, I'm just going through all of them if you can't tell.
Yeah.
Lincoln was. What are we thinking here?
Boy, I don't know.
Oh, boy. Not a citizen of the... Ron, is this a trick question or is there some easy explanation for this one?
There is an explanation for it.
Eli, you're nodding. Do you know the answer to this question?
I only looked it up just to make sure
that
this
was... Oh, so you cheated.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not participating.
Okay, okay.
But I do know, and I can
and it's legit.
Confirm that there is an explanation to be had.
Okay. All right.
Not McKinley,
let's
not
just jump
Teddy.
To the answer here.
Well, hold on. Give us one clue, Ron. Give us a little clue. You already won, but give a clue.
I will tell you when this president was inaugurated was April 4th, 1841.
1841.
Oh, come on. That should be a giveaway.
Boy, we're bad, Schwanny. Schwann is completely. I think Schwann has broken down, Ron.
Yeah,
you have broken.
My mind is really reeling here on this. Yeah.
I mean, William Henry Harrison died. That would probably be William Henry Harrison time. Is it William Henry Harrison, Ron?
No. William Henry Harrison died,
4th.
And John Tyler became president on April 4th.
And so it's John Tyler. Why? Yeah. I should have known that from April 4th. That was the obvious answer there. Why was John Tyler not a U.S. citizen when he died?
He was a loyal Virginian, and when the Confederacy was started, he became a member of the Confederacy and died in 1862 as a citizen of the Confederacy.
Wow.
There you go.
Ron.
That explains it.
Well, that was a really bad start for us, Schwann.
I know, but you know what? How great is it that we get to learn something like this each and every time we do this? Thank you, Ron.
That's a nice way to say it. I'm mad. Ron, go away.
No, just kidding. There's always more to learn. Thanks, Ron.
Well, now I feel like in the future, let's get Ron on the line. Ron can be the John and Schwann lifeline. Ron, you good? We play this game sporadically, so just whenever you get a phone call from 312-981-7200, pick up, okay?
I will do that.
Thanks, Ron. I know you get a high five from us the next time we see you.
Sounds good.
All right. I'm embarrassed, Dave Schwann, especially when he said April.
April, yeah.
I should have known, okay, a month after.
Yeah, well, William Henry Harrison, if I'm not mistaken, was from southern Indiana.
Yeah.
So he was,
Tippecanoe and Taylor, too.
Tyler, too.
Boy, I'm off to a bad start. Sunday morning. Racking my brain here trying to make it all work. Okay. Well, if anyone else wants to call in and beat Ron and stump the Schwann and John, the water's warm. You can tell it's not as hard as as we thought it was. Boy, we really build ourselves up there. You know, when we do the show over again, Eli, when we do this in real time, in the live in the replay of this broadcast, let's make sure we edit that one out. Let's fix it on up. All right, Andy Mazur, let's let you shine here a little bit.
Talk to me.
20th anniversary since the White Sox. Big celebrations on the South Side here this weekend. Huh?
Yeah, Mark Burley had a statue unveiled of himself out in right field in the concourse. And yesterday, the World Series trophy appeared at home plate, and there was a big ceremony there. And the guys were honoring and doing a nice toast with Miller Lights to the dear departed Bobby Jenks, who passed away last week at the age of 44. And contrary to what ESPN said in its obituary, he was on the roster, but he was also on the mound when the White Sox won the World Series back in Houston in 2005.
Man, ESPN has had some issues with how they portray the 2005 White Sox, many times not remembering
exactly.
them.
Exactly. They ignored them a few times. So.
Yeah. And they, as a, that 05 team, that 05 playoff run, I'm a diehard Cubs fan, mm-hmm. and I don't particularly like the Sox, but I was captivated by that run, I think, as just a baseball nut at how good that pitching was in that World Series and in the ALCS against the Angels, Andy.
Yeah, there were several complete games within the framework of the ALCS and also the World Series. And you think about that final game, they won 1-0. Jermaine Dye had a single in the eighth inning. It was a scoreless game. They had great defense. Juan Uribe was playing shortstop out of his mind. In that final game, he made the catch on the foul ball that took him into the stands, and then he completed the final out with a little chopper over Jenks' head and a throw an eyelash ahead of the runner at first base to end it and to win the World Series. So it was it's funny because they've described themselves as kind of a collection of misfits that came together and really gelled and liked each other. And that's A.J. Brzezinski was talking about that yesterday, just the fact that that team, they really enjoyed each other's company. There were a bunch of guys in there that were just good old fashioned beer drinking guys that wanted to go out there and play at their hardest and then play their hardest after the game too.
Yeah, they were a fun team to watch. It's some crazy stat, Andy. You'll have to look it up for me later on if you don't know off the top of your head. And I don't remember if it's the World Series or the ALCS, which was a 5-game series. Mm-hmm. Including that big drop third strike call in game two, if I'm remembering correctly.
Doug Eddings, the umpire?
Boy, we're
still has no idea what he did.
If you don't remember, go back and look. But maybe it was that ALCS. I think the bullpen pitched 2/3 of an inning in the entire series. Something insane like that. Look those. I don't know if you're able to go through the old box scores
they had 4 complete games.
In the ALCS.
In the ALCS.
And I think the other one was 8 1/3.
Yeah. They didn't need the guys. They really did not need anybody from the bullpen. Because Contreras, in game one, pitched 8 1/3. So there's your 2/3 of an inning in the ALCS.
That is wild.
Neil Kotz, by the way, was the only guy that pitched out of the bullpen in that series.
The whole series?
Yeah.
I'm also amazed I had that right on the money. I didn't know anything about my presidential history, apparently.
It's okay.
But I remembered that. Boy, 2/3 of an inning over 5.
2/3 of an inning. And yeah, I mean, think about the fact that he was 2/3 of an inning away from yet another complete game. We were watching, I was at Channel 9 yesterday, we were watching the replay of the final game, and Freddy Garcia was just lights out in that final game. It was crazy to watch how well they pitched.
Yeah, I'm a big Cubs fan. I just remember, I'll never forget where I was watching the Sox game two with my best friend growing up, Kent, who was a diehard Sox fan, still is. But watching the game two Konerko Grand Slam, even as a Cub, I was so jealous. I have to admit. I mean, it wasn't hatred. I wasn't upset, but I was so jealous of White Sox fans for getting to experience that. But I was so happy for my friends that were happy. I mean, that was the first World Series in this city since 1917.
Yeah, it's the truth. I mean, and you know what? It was just the other way around in 2016 because, you know, I was getting phone calls and texts from my White Sox friends who were saying, "Hey, I'm really happy for you." And I was,
oh, that's nice.
You know, that's, you know, there's hatred, quote unquote, you know, between the two teams in the city. But I don't think anybody in Chicago was rooting against the White Sox in 2005.
I hope not. I'm sure there were a few. I'm sure there were a few White Sox fans rooting against the Cubs. But I think the vast majority of people. Here's what I've said this before on this station. I feel like everyone who's a Sox fan or a Cubs fan agrees on this. I don't care. You know, if you're a Sox fan, that's fine. I'm a Cubs fan. So be it. As long as you don't say I'm a fan of both teams. Because I mean, we can do it here at WGN. Of course, we want both teams to succeed. We're all Chicago. But, like, when it comes down to asking you, which one do you prefer? No wishy-washy both sides stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. And, you know, that's the reason that, you know, people that don't live in Chicago always kind of balk when I say, hey, Chicago is a Bears town. And they're like, what do you mean? They got the Cubs. I'm like, no, because the allegiances in baseball are divided in the city. Not everybody roots for the one team. It's a Bears town because everybody roots for the Bears, right. White Sox fans and Cubs fans. But you know, it's difficult to me to say that you are a fan of both. It's hard to quantify. Let's put you that way.
Yeah, I don't like that. So don't tell me that, okay, everyone?
I'm not going to tell you that.
Thank you very much, Andy. Yeah. Shwani, by the way, bringing this full circle to the President John Tyler factoid that we had earlier about William Henry Harrison being the first president that we got right off the bat. No problems with that answer. I forgot. I've mentioned this fact. This whenever I do a segment like "What's the craziest fact you know," it was always until a couple months ago that President John Tyler, who was inaugurated as we learned in 1841, just now in April, as I remembered off the top of my head, his grandson was still alive until a couple months ago.
Oh, that's right.
John Tyler had a kid in his 70s. Mm-hmm. That kid had a kid in his 70s.
There's definitely longevity in that family.
And two of the grandsons were alive as of a couple years ago. One passed away a couple years ago. And then, as the texter reminded me, another one just passed away. That is just mind-boggling. John Tyler was born in the 18th century. And to have a grandkid still alive in 2025 is crazy.
How old were they when they finally...
in their 90s.
Had to have been. Yeah, if not pushing 100.
And then longevity is incredible. Boy, we're just learning a lot of things today, people. Is this what Dean does? History time with Dean Richards? I'd listen to that. Anyways, we're going to get some more history with the far-flung forecast I know a little bit about. We'll take a break. We'll do Dave Schwann's news and plenty more. Oh, we're going to chat with our Northwestern doctor, too. We're just getting started. John Hanson in for Dean Richards. Give us a call. Give us a text. 312-981-7200. Join the conversation. More after this on WGN. The 847 texted in. Grew up in Mount Prospect. Live in Elk Grove Village now, and they are a Brewers fan. Okay. Andy, I wish the Brewers would start losing some games. Well, they are always there in the hunt. Even when they're 500 for the first 2 months, they always find a way lately.
And to add insult to injury, yesterday the game tying double in the ninth inning came off the bat of Andrew Vaughn.
Mm. That microphone moving sound effect is all you needed to hear in my silence. Okay, what's the game where the Cubs are two games now?
One. Uno.
I don't like that.
One more than you and I.
312-981-7200. Join the conversation with us. Please call on in. We're going to be chatting with Dr. Gabriel Wallace in just a little bit about the expansion of Northwestern's vascular care. I'm going to ask him what vascular care is. Those are words I've heard before. I don't know much about it. He's going to jump in, and we'll do the far-flung forecast with Dave Schwann, and we'll continue to take your calls for Stump the Schwann and John. So far, the listeners lead Dave and myself 1-0. Dave, we got to get on the board here, but we need some callers, too. We'll have time for that in the 10 o'clock hour. Time for Dave Schwann's news here on 720 WGN. All right. Thank you very much, Dave Schwann. Great report, as always. And let's keep this train rolling with our far-flung forecast. Hey, Schwani, what do you got for us here today?
Well, thank you very much, John. Friends and neighbors, get out your compasses and protractors and newfangled devices. We head down south to Tennessee today, Dayton, Tennessee. Population 7,065. This is in You know what, John? I'm never quite sure how to say the name of the county. It's either Rhea County, as in Rhea Perlman, because it's spelled the same way as her name, or it could be Ray County, Tennessee. Not real sure.
Wait, how's it spelled?
R-H-E-A.
Someone will call in for that. Yeah. Let us know how to say it. Ron, where's Ron when you need him?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so we're going to Tennessee.
Dayton, Tennessee, and as I say, population a little over 7,000. It's always been one of those small communities in rural Tennessee, but 100 years ago this week, Dayton, Tennessee was the center of attention in the United States, and not only across the country, but really internationally. This was the site of the famous Scopes Monkey Trial, where the giant legal figures were brought in for this. For the prosecution, William Jennings Bryan, who ran for president a couple, three times. And, of course, John, you and I would know William Jennings Bryan because he was known for what was called the Cross of Gold speech in the 1890s, given right here in Chicago, by the way. But also a Chicagoan participated for the defense. Clarence Darrow went down to help defend John Scopes, who was accused and of violating what was then a state law, teaching evolution in the school system, and was on trial for that. He was indeed found guilty, but that conviction was later overturned. But also, because this garnered such attention, WGN Radio started not only live coverage of the proceedings, but also set up a small network, which in my mind is just extraordinary for
1925.
In 1925, to set up a radio network so other stations would be able to carry the broadcast. I'm thinking also that may have been the start of what was then known as the Mutual Broadcasting System.
I bet you're right.
Yeah.
I pulled up the newspaper of the Tribune from 100 years ago today, and I've done this segment before where
I'd love to see it.
I'll pull it up for you in the newsroom here in a moment.
You know what else I would love?
What's that?
Any and all audio from then.
Oh.
I don't know if it exists or not, but I can tell you, when you go down to the county courthouse, which is still in use to this very day, there's a museum there in the courthouse, and WGN is featured prominently. And by the way, the their centennial celebrations are well underway. There's a what's called a Scopes 100 centennial celebration. Looking at the website this morning, it's really cool.
That is cool. You want me to read what the Tribune said?
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
So the front page is all about Scopes Monkey Trial, and then every day the Tribune would publish what was on WGN, of course, owned by the same company. And
the world's greatest newspaper.
And I've had a lot of fun looking at some of the segments. There was a couple days ago, I was in for Lisa, and I noticed that at 3 p.m. a couple days ago, 100 years ago, there was something called rocking chair time on the radio. So we were, took us a little while to find our groove here at WGN. But here's what it said today, Monday, July the 13th. 100 years ago today, would you like to be seated in the courtroom at Dayton, Tennessee today and hear the proceedings of the evolution trial? All you have to do is listen in on WGN, the Chicago Tribune station on the Drake Hotel from 9:45 Chicago time on, and the WGN microphones in the little court will bring you every sound of the sessions to you. WGN, it goes on to say, has the exclusive right to broadcast the evolution trial from inside the courtroom. Microphones have been placed by engineer Paul G. Neal of the station above the judge's bench and before the witness stand. Between sessions today, Quinn Ryan, director of WGN, will give a comprehensive radio picture of the
setting. He did everything. Ryan did news, sports, music, you name it.
He's going to give a comprehensive radio picture of the setting from his coop in the courtroom, as he has done at the biggest sporting events that have been put on the air. Don't miss the speeches of Brian and Darrow today on the radio, 100 years ago.
Oh, man.
I have to reshare. Maybe we'll do this tomorrow on WGN's website. A couple years ago, we published, I remember listening to this when I was younger, John Williams, for the 75th anniversary, went down and broadcast from the courtroom.
From the courtroom, yeah, yeah.
And I was listening to some of those old recordings of John doing that 25 years ago, 25 years ago, And it was fascinating. First of all, John Williams is still just the most stellar broadcaster and host, and was 25 years ago. It's captivating to listen to.
Yeah.
And him recapping. But he had a lot of cool features that he did down there, and we'll have to republish some of that or get it up at the top of the website, Dave. But good stuff.
Thank you. It is. It never ceases to fascinate me. And don't forget that the Scopes Monkey Trial was the basis for the great play Inherit the Wind.
Oh, yeah.
Which was superbly produced at Goodman Theater last year.
Wait, I forget, Dave. Do you actually give the forecast for this place or no?
Yes, I do. Right. We have sunny skies and day.
It's like we almost forgot that.
Right. That's what was the basis for this. 79 degrees, sunny in Dayton. And by the way, 100 years ago, it was devastatingly hot. They moved the proceedings outside because it was too hot in the courtroom. It's going to be hot there today, 88 and into the 90s this week.
I'll have more history of heat with you, Dave. Not only on this day 100 years ago, I saw a story in the Tribune of 270,000 people packing the Chicago beaches on this day 100 years ago to beat the heat that wow. you mentioned was still, and obviously probably hotter and more permeating in Tennessee, but a little bit also about the heat wave from 30 years ago. Okay, we'll do that. And, oh, Eli told me it was Ray County, right? Yep,
Ray County. Ray County?
He watched an ad for it.
Okay, so, great.
Well, let me get you up. Go ahead, Eli.
Oh, I pulled up an ad and I saw locals say Ray County themselves, so I'm going to trust them on that.
I would hope
we'll
so.
Go with
they,
that.
They better
we'll
get the ad that. Right. All right, we're yep. going to talk to our Northwestern doc after this on WGN. Forty-two here on WGN. John Hansen in for Dean Richards. We'll take it till 1 o'clock here this afternoon. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Text in, call in, anything you want. Join the conversation, of course. Hey, Northwestern Medicine, Palos Hospital is announcing a new hybrid vascular operating room, which, according to the article I'm reading, brings leading-edge surgical technology and advanced vascular care to the South Suburbs. That sounds like good news. Dr. Gabriel Wallace joins us now. He is a vascular surgeon and director of vascular surgery at Northwestern Medicine, Palos Hospital. Hello, Dr. Wallace.
Good morning, John. Thanks so much for having me on the radio. It's a real privilege to be interviewed by an Emmy and Silver Dome Award journal.
Well, look at that. Yeah, I wish every guest would read my credentials out beforehand. Thank you, Dr. Wallace. I got to ask, this is a dumb question, but this is why, you know, I got that Silver Dome Award. What is vascular surgery, for those that don't know, including myself?
Thanks, John. Vascular surgery is a subspecialty of general surgery. Vascular surgeons typically go to medical school for 4 years, followed by a general surgery residency for 5 years minimum, up to 7 years, depending on research. And then typically a 2-year fellowship in vascular and endovascular therapy. There's also a new route that is somewhat expedited, which is between 5 and 7 years, called the direct pathway. And vascular surgeons are blood vessel surgeons who operate on the vascular system, which essentially is all of the arteries and veins, except for those that are in the skull themselves or attached to the heart or directly on the heart.
So cardiologists or cardiac surgeons do the heart. Someone else, the brain surgeons, do the brain. And you guys do the rest of the arteries and veins everywhere else in the body.
That's correct. We operate essentially from the top of the neck all the way down to the toes, whether it be the carotid arteries, the aorta, the iliac arteries, arteries in the leg or the arms, and then the veins as well.
What sorts of things are you guys fixing in there?
Vascular surgeons typically operate for blockages or aneurysms. So we're opening up blockages and doing bypasses around blockages, using stents and balloon angioplasty to open up blockages, replacing arteries that are aneurysmal. And a large component of our work also that is not typically public-facing is supporting the invasive operations in the remainder of the hospital, so helping out other physicians who may be doing invasive procedures in the operating room or the emergency room, interventional radiology, or the intensive care unit. We're always on backup to help out in case someone needs a hand with these types of procedures or runs into trouble.
What you guys do may not operate directly on the heart or the brain, but I imagine keeping the arteries and veins clear or as clear as they can be ultimately helps heart and brain health, right?
Well, there's very specific indications for repairing blockages. We don't typically fix blockages unless there's a reason to, and not all blockages need to be treated. There is some evidence coming out in the scientific literature that improving the blood flow to the brain may help with memory and some types of dementia, but that is currently not an indication for revascularization of the carotid arteries or the arteries that go to the brain. With the main indication right now for intervening on the blood supply to the brain being stroke risk reduction or stroke prevention.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of getting at. I imagine that that all helps just your overall health. So this new center, you know, when we talk about the advances that have been made in all sorts of medical fields, I imagine the same can be said for vascular surgery, right? I mean, I'm sure it's been a groundbreaking 20 plus years in the study of this.
Right now is a super exciting time for vascular surgery. We've seen a real tremendous improvement in the imaging modalities that we have over the last two decades.
What does that mean, Sai?
We're really, really excited about the different imaging modalities or the different ways that we use imaging to both help to diagnose vascular problems and also treat them in a way that's easier for patients to go through. Whereas 30 years ago or so, most of the operations were open, such as treatment of an abdominal aortic aneurysm or what is called AAA, requiring a big operation with a week or two in the hospital and months to recover. Now we can diagnose and perform an operation for and have a patient home the next day because of our ability to use CT scans, contrast-enhanced CT scans, X-ray-based technology such as fluoroscopy or angiography, and ultrasound both in and outside of the body. When it's inside, it's called intravascular ultrasound. But the advent of this room brings together all these amazing imaging technologies in a way that we can offer operations to be done faster, safer, more minimally invasive, and with less radiation to help patients get through them faster and get home faster.
It makes sense. The more you can see and the better you can see it, the more targeted I bet you can be. Once you actually go in there, you mentioned in the years past it would be an open surgery. Are there advances in the technology of how minuscule these tools can be to get in and do their job?
Absolutely. Sometimes open surgery is still needed, and sometimes these technologies can help us to make an open operation less invasive, which we would call, quote-unquote, a hybrid operation using some minimally invasive components or X-ray components combined with an open exposure or some part of an open operation. But even still, many of these operations that took large incisions before can be done with a 1 centimeter incision now in a one-night hospital stay.
If someone, I guess what I was asking, because I know there's so many different things that can bring you in front of a vascular surgeon, but like just us at home, are there symptoms or signs or things any of us should be looking for that might indicate there's something wrong with our arteries and vessels in our body right now?
That is a great question, John. The answer is really broad. Typically, one would have a problem recognized by a primary care provider or a cardiologist that would lead to a referral to a vascular surgeon more so than somebody recognizing something on their own and self-referring. But obviously, any signs or symptoms of stroke or family history of someone having an aneurysm or pain in the legs or calves while you're walking would be something to bring up to your primary care provider or cardiologist and they could evaluate further and determine whether a referral to a vascular surgeon would be the right next step.
So they kind of do the heavy lift isn't the right term. They do the initial look at, see, and talk through it, and then they would refer us to you.
Mostly correct, yes.
Okay. Mostly correct should be in my bio, too. I'll take that anytime, Dr. Wallace, if I'm mostly correct about anything. Okay, so you're excited about this new technology. What contributes to some of the problems that lead to people showing up in your vascular surgeon's room or wherever you are? Is it all the standard things that we know we should be doing better with diet and exercise, helping keep our veins and arteries as clean as possible, or do genetics play a large role, all of the above?
You got it. You're welcome to come on into my office sometime and help me out, honestly. Smoking is the main risk factor, both for blockages and for aneurysms and progression of aneurysms. And then all of the typical risk factors for what we call atherosclerotic disease or hardening of the arteries, heart disease, play a part for vascular disease as well, high blood pressure, uncontrolled diabetes, non-optimal weight, and of course, typical American diet are all contributors to vascular disease.
Anything else you want to say about your new center or what you're doing and what you're excited about?
Oh, absolutely. We're really excited about this operating room. Our goal in the Bloom Cardiovascular Institute is really to bring academic level cardiovascular care to where people live and work without having to travel, and bring the greatest and newest technology to our community where patients can access it on their terms.
Congratulations on keep going. Sorry, sir.
Oh, yeah. And would it be okay if I gave a couple shout-outs?
Oh, please. I mean, how many's a couple? I mean,
There's a few.
Okay.
Because the surgeon is generally the most visible person, but everybody knows my team really well. All of our patients know my team, and it's really important to remember that every surgeon is backed up by a large team that allows these operations to be planned, performed, and followed up without a hitch. So my thanks to Neil Bloom and the other contributors who made the Bloom Cardiovascular Institute possible going into our 20th anniversary. Thanks to Doug Johnson, Patrick McCarthy, and Mark Escondieri for steering the Cardiovascular Institute. My mentors from Northwestern and University of Washington, Mark Escondieri, Andy Houle, Ben Starrs, and Nam Tran, and our whole outpatient and inpatient team. Can I keep going for a sec?
Sure, go ahead.
The team is so important, really. Our team is so important because we really try to provide care to patients that we would want for our own family. And so our team is really like family, and we approach our patient care this way. So our medical assistants, Nancy Andrade, Alyssa Garoga, Chrissy Batzel, our nurses, Dave Gonzalez and Kristen Pintozzi, our advanced practice practitioners, Rachel Briel, Ethan Wells, Katie Vella, our sonographers, Kathy Bernotovicius, Amal Tamalier, Kelly Cermak, my partners downtown, and my partner on site, Dr. Nanda Nath, and our administrative partners, our hospital president, Mike Vivoda, who has been instrumental in supporting our programmatic growth and this operating room to be built, Sunan Muthars and John Mulrooney, Sarah Plaskett,
wow,
Kate Matusik, and Matt Tyke.
Okay, you set a record. I think I'm going to stop you right there. I think I counted 19. I thought you were going to do kids and spouse. I'm not opening the door for that. Hey, whatever, man. We got 4 hours to fill, so we got, you killed about a minute with some names there. No, I love the idea of that, too, right? You do get to be the forward-facing person, and I totally get that, too, as someone who gets to be the person on the microphone. It takes an entire team and village to put this all together. I'm sure it's the exact same thing in Northwestern, your entire hospital, let alone Palos Hospital and all that you guys do. I appreciate all the shout-outs, Dr. Wallace. That was great. And I worry to ask this. Anything else you want to add?
No, thanks so much. Okay. We're always accepting new patients. We're happy to provide second opinions. We try to make it really approachable and make the actual logistics of the care and the care coordination seamless so that people can really focus on the actual medical component of the care and the surgical component of care, and not have to worry about when the appointment is or having the imaging that they need. We try to take care of all of that. So we're easy to get a hold of through the main line. I can say that if you like, but we're always available with our office on site at Palos Hospital and a new outpatient center in Mokena to provide the best services we can for the South region.
Before I let you go, 6-3-0 wanted to know, this is for the vascular doctor. If you have a CT scan that is not the contrast one, for an aneurysm in an abdomen, can you see it just from a traditional CT scan?
Great question. Absolutely, you can see it. So if you have a CT scan of, the abdomen and the pelvis, it will show all of the structures. The contrast can be administered at different points in the cardiac cycle. So when you give contrast through an IV, it can either light up the veins or the arteries or both or the soft tissues. And so the best CT scan to look at an arterial problem would be an arterial protocol contrast CT or CT angiogram CTA, which really lights up the arteries themselves. But even without the contrast, with a standard non-contrast CT scan, you can see the outline of everything. You can see the calcium, and you can absolutely see if there's an aneurysm or not and measure it. So say someone has a small aneurysm on a non-contrast CT scan and they come to see me, that's completely adequate to make a recommendation for surveillance interval and type of surveillance and all the other associated screening and counseling that comes along with an aneurysm diagnosis. If you have a non-contrast CT scan and it's big enough that it's indicated for repair, we would then follow that up with a CT angiogram for actual operative planning.
Okay, so a CT scan, we'll get it. I thought you were about to give us the list of the people who invented the CT scan, but shout out to them as well. Dr. Wallace, we are out of time. I appreciate it. Congratulations on everything. We'll talk soon, okay?
Thanks, John. Have a great day.
It's Dr. Gabriel Wallace. Having a little fun. He did ask ahead of time if he could give some shout-outs, and he sure did. Love that. Hey, tell you what, let's take a break. We have news coming up from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN. All righty, 10:06 on WGN. John Hanson in for Mr. Dean Richards himself. Andy, you said the announcement for the All-Star Game coming at the end of the month?
Yeah, that's according to Bob Nightingale today on the USA Today. You know, obviously, there's been a lot of reporting that the All-Star Game is coming to Chicago at Wrigley Field in 2027.
That's awesome.
It hadn't been approved yet at that point, but apparently now it has been because the Cubs have agreed to make the necessary upgrades in security around the ballpark, which is always a concern now of Major League Baseball. And I think City Council kind of helped out in that respect as well. And I believe the announcement is scheduled for July 30th.
Okay, so that'll be 37 years after the previous one in 1990.
Yeah.
So that kind of makes sense. 32 teams and got some new stadiums and people you got to please. They'll be great, though. My dad was at the 1962 All-Star
Game. Oh, really?
At Wrigley Field, which was the second All-Star Game that year. Yeah, there were two that year.
Mm-hmm.
And
a game that had to be played in daylight at that time, by the way.
Oh, for sure. By a lot. But the roster is pretty incredible. Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris.
Wow.
So many others. Sorry, I'm just going through these. But Willie Mays. All these people my dad got to see in person. He sat in the bleachers, if I remember. Mil Pappas when he was at the Orioles.
Right.
Ernie Banks, of course. Eddie Matthews. Hank Aaron. Wow.
It's a whole
Stan Musial, Frank Robinson, Billy Williams.
It's a who's who of Hall of Famers.
That is a who's
that's for
who.
Sure.
Brooks Robinson.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yogi Berra. All my dad got to see in 1962. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I can't wait for it to come back to Wrigley. I was at the All-Star Game in 2003.
Yeah, I was there too, covering that actually for this radio station.
Oh, look at that. I went to all 4 days of it, including the Home Run Derby, which is the only time I've been punched at a game. Or at an event.
Really?
It was not a full-on decking of my face, but I'll explain. I was in foul territory at the Home Run Derby thinking, I'll never get a ball, a home run ball. And it was Jason Giambi. I was down the right field line.
Mm-hmm.
I was 19 years old at the time. The ball hit off the foul pole on the foul side of it, so a fair home run.
Yeah.
And it ricocheted to my belly.
Oh.
In like the fourth row of wherever I was sitting in foul territory. And I was like, I got a ball until someone else landed a fist in my belly and took the ball from me.
Oh, man.
I'm still bitter about that.
You should be.
I don't think he was like, I'm going to punch this 19-year-old. I think it was more of like the scramble to get the ball.
Yeah.
Still not happy about it, as you can tell.
You know, you mentioned Jason Giambi. I have a quick story about him from the 2002 Home Run Derby that was in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
So I was covering that, and the overflow media, for whatever reason, at then Miller Park, was above the bullpen in right field.
Okay.
Jason Giambi hit a ball on a screaming liner. It may have gotten 20 feet off the ground, maybe 25. Yeah. It must have been coming in at 1,000.5 miles an hour. It destroyed a gentleman's computer.
Oh, wow. Just knocked it like a laptop that he had there?
And as he tried to stop it, it also destroyed his hand.
Oh, no.
Well, he was trying to protect his computer.
Oh, well.
And it just obliterated that thing.
Wow. Oh, that's amazing.
For whatever reason, they had us in right field. I mean, you could not look away for 10
seconds.
You're
probably still 400 feet away, and that thing still did that.
Oh, my goodness.
That's awesome.
Yeah, Sosa was hitting bombs into the left field in that game, in that derby.
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned the heat. Dave, what's the high temperature you got here for today? It's going to be a muggy, what, near 90 or something?
Well, today it's going to be nice, 85.
Oh, okay.
Tomorrow, the heat returns hot and humid. And we could see heat indices around 100 in some places for tomorrow.
I've got
Today, mostly sunny, less humid, high around 86.
So enjoy today, hot tomorrow. I've got a tip for people to keep their home cool. I read about this in the UK. Lou Manfredini didn't suggest this on his show, I'll tell you that much. It involves putting something on your windows. Think about that. I'll get your guesses after this on WGN. WGN. Good Sunday morning, everyone. John Hansen in for Mr. Dean Richards till 1 o'clock. Okay. A researcher in the UK trying to keep his house cool found that putting what on the windows kept his house cool. Any guesses, Mr. Mazur?
Is this from Sir Fix It as opposed to Mr. Fix It?
That's a good one. Yes, okay. Sir Fix It in the UK.
Correct.
He hosts Saturday mornings there out in London. Actually, the town I have it here is, this is Loughborough, L-O-U-G-H, Borough?
Loughborough, maybe?
Loughborough?
Yeah.
Loughborough University?
Loughborough.
His name is Dr. Ben Roberts, or Sir Fix It, as Andy coined him. What does he put on the windows to keep things cool?
Why was the first thing that came to mind, and I hope I'm not right, because I don't want to ruin your bit.
That's fine. I hope you are right.
I was going to say like Vaseline or something like that.
Nope, not Vaseline, although okay. I think something it has a similar spreadability.
Okay.
I guess you could say.
So not that far off.
Eli already knows the answer, so he can't guess. Okay. Schwani's currently doing this to the 303 Wacker building here. It got a little hot for Schwani in the newsroom. So what Dave Schwann has done is he's go ahead and he's rappelling from the top floor down to the 18th right now, and he is spreading yogurt.
Yogurt
all over the windows.
Interesting.
Dr. Ben Roberts is a senior lecturer in healthy buildings. That's awesome. At Loughborough University. Correct my pronunciation. 312-917-200 says applying yogurt, which by the way over there is spelled with an H somewhere in there.
Okay.
It's yogurt.
Just like donut over there, probably, right?
Yeah, that's one. Yeah. Right. Or putting the color with the U.
Yeah.
Color
and Centra.
That's right. Centra. So yogurt, if you put some yogurt on your windows, it can lower the temperature by as much as 3.5 degrees Celsius. Andy, how many degrees is that in Fahrenheit?
Well, let's see.
No wonder why Schwani walked away this segment.
32 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm thinking it's, I don't know.
6.3 degrees Fahrenheit.
I was just going to say 6.4.
Oh, well, you were close. Just over, and you lose some Price is Right rules. But it lowers the temperature of your house by 6.3 degrees.
But then you have to clean it.
You do. Exactly. There's a lot of, and he admits there's a lot of flaws in this argument. But he did this month-long experiment to show that it really has brought results. He says, we can get houses to cool down during the day. This is a real problem for people. They're having a heat wave there now, which I think in London is like 80, but they don't have air conditioning, right? So like a lot of people always like mock the UK or Europe when they're going through a heat wave, but they don't have air conditioning because they don't get these extreme temperatures in the UK all that often. But they said there's a real problem for people. We've started looking at shading solutions, stopping getting sun from your house during the day. Someone in the text line suggested aluminum foil, and he talks about aluminum foil actually lowering the temperature 6 degrees Celsius. So, oh gosh, I got to do the math there. 6 times 1.8. So if you put aluminum foil on your houses, you get better Wi-Fi reception too, and your house temperature lowers 10.8 degrees.
Not as hard to clean either.
Exactly, but probably harder to put up. You can spread a little yogurt up on the windows, no problem. And he told the BBC that the yogurt, smells for 30 seconds while drying, but as soon as it's dried, the smell disappears. Huh. And for their experiment, they went to the supermarket and they bought Greek yogurt with a fat percentage around 10%. And he said he was quite surprised. He didn't think it would be that effective. But he did this to show that there's an importance of treating windows and heat shielding solutions for windows to reduce overheating. Schwani's back from yogurting up all the windows here at 303 East Wacker. Dave, you should have taken a quick shower. We've got him here on the floor. You looked a little gross right now.
I've been told that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, generally speaking, yes, that's a baseline. But now that you're covered in yogurt, would you ever experiment with that, Dave? Your house get too hot? Put a little yogurt on the windows?
I hadn't even thought about it until you just mentioned it.
I don't think anyone had until this guy did.
Hadn't even considered it.
Yeah, I mean, there are, I mean, look, let's be honest. Our houses do get, even with the air conditionings running, you know, we struggle to keep up. I am surprised. Maybe there is this technology out there, just too darn expensive. That, you know how, like, on our glass, did you ever have, Andy, you wear glasses. I do too, but I wear contacts now. Did you ever have the ones that changed the tint?
I'm wearing them right now.
Oh, wait, those are, what are they called?
Transition.
You wear in transition glasses? Mm-hmm. You walk outside, they turn into sunglasses? Yep. I didn't know those were still around and popular. Yeah. Why can't they make our windows into, like, transition windows?
That's a good point. I mean, we found, too, I mean, at our place, just especially in the afternoon, because we get direct sunlight, they just shutting the drapes really helps.
Yeah, imagine that.
Or closing the blinds.
Closing the blinds.
Just really, really helps.
You know what we did in the house, because the basement's so cold and our upstairs is not, that I set up a series of, and this was a Lou Manfredini recommendation. I don't know if he wanted me to go this far, but I bought 4 box fans on Amazon because they came the next day or later that day. This is when it was hot for those like 7 days in a row. And I had one box fan at the bottom of the basement shooting up the stairs.
There you go.
I then had another box fan at the top of the basement stairs shooting it parallel to them to get over to the other set of stairs, in which I had another box fan shoot up those stairs. And then one more box fan at the top shooting into David's room to make sure he was getting the cold air from the basement into the room. Because babies, you don't want to get too much heat in the house.
Yeah.
But I still wanted him up in the crib up the upstairs, which is hotter. It was the loudest house you've ever been in for 5.5
cool?
days. I still have humming in my ears from the five. At one point, Enrique's like, it's 88. It's now in the 8. We got to stop. Like, I cannot function. I cannot hear myself think in this house of box fans. But I tell you what, Lou Manfredini, it worked. That place was a lot cooler. Oh, and changing the air filter on my air conditioning, which I hadn't done in 3.5 years.
Yeah.
That was not good. Yeah,
holy mackerel.
I felt like a real dummy when I did that.
How'd you even get that out of there?
I know, right? Yeah. I think I got like emphysema just by taking it out of the air conditioner. Yeah, that was dumb. I have a newborn at home. You think that would be one of the first things I would have done on the dad list. But hey, I set a calendar reminder for the next one.
How often are you going
to
do it?
I think like 3 months is when you're supposed to do it.
Yeah, we have a dog, so it's I try to do mine every couple months.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, that was dumb of me. That was an oversight. I'll admit my shortcoming there. I also have one of those HVACs that has just the strangest air filter. I got to ask Lou to come on over and take a look at this thing. It's not like the thin one, you know, that you put in a lot of systems.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a box. It's like 5 inches wide.
Oh, really?
And it barely fits in the thing. I have to like jam it in there because it's like a European HVAC the guy put in and the late previous owner. That doesn't like have a set standard air filter. So who knows if it's even working. This is why I probably didn't replace it that long. But I just jammed that thing in there. It's running much better now, though.
Yeah, I have to bend my filter to get it into the slot because the water heater is right next to it. This is in a little closet where our washer and dryer are.
So you have to bend it?
I literally have to get down on the floor because their pipes come across for the water heater. And I bend it. And then I take the first one out and bend it and put the second one in.
You MacGyver it.
You have to do what you have to do.
Got to get that air filter in.
Exactly right.
If you got to turn it into the shape of a C to go around a pipe, that's what you do.
It's more of an L, yeah. It's more of an L. It's like a little right angle.
Right. Jeff, it's an L.
The fun is just watching me get down on the floor and then the better fun is watching me try to get back up.
Yeah, she needs to videotape that. And
Melina will take care of that.
Post that up on social media. Yeah. 224 wants to know how Enrique feels about me living at WGN part-time. He gets to turn off the fans when I'm gone, so I think he's fine with it, even with the newborn.
Peace and quiet.
Peace, fairly so. 312-981-7200. The 630 says, this fan thing now means you officially are a father. Everyone has a system for setting up fans for cooling. Yep. That was a definite dad move, I will say, doing stuff like that. 847 says, perforated vinyl window sheet cut to size, like you see in the advertisements at the fast food chains, and you can still see through when looking out.
Mm-hmm.
You purchase at a sign store. Okay. That's a lot of windows you got to do. You got to go on the ladder as well. If only, because really you could just slop that yogurt on up
Yeah, use a paintbrush.
Just get those single size yogurts and just launch them at the windows. They splatter. You're good for a little bit. 6.3 degrees cooler in the house with yogurt on the windows. Okay. All right, we'll get more tips on that. If you want to stump the Schwann and John and stop yogurt talk, now is your time. 312-981-7200. Do you have a useless piece of presidential trivia? Schwanny and I are 0-for-1 today. Ron stumped us. Can you be next? You get a prize. It's a high five from both of us next on WGN. 1025 on WGN. It's John Hanson in for Dean Richards. I'm just chuckling here, Schwanny. I know you and Andy are chatting, but... someone just called in for Stump the Schwann and John, asked what the prize was, and when told that it was high fives for me and you, the caller said, never mind.
And they hung up.
Look, sorry, I didn't think that far ahead. I'm sure if I had asked the appropriate powers that be for some prizes, we would have gotten them. So I can't officially, and I don't want to call anyone on a Sunday, any of our bosses. Nobody wants that. I'll send you the shirt off my back if it'll help you stump the Schwann. And actually, not this one.
I was going to say, it's a nice
I like
Black
this.
Yes,
yeah, this is a new Blackhawk shirt.
Autograph it. You have to autograph it.
Oh, man, an autographed John Hanson shirt?
You have
shirt?
To autograph it.
Ooh, don't put that on eBay. You'll be scared how much money that'll go for. Ooh, boy. A game-worn, a host-worn shirt?
Host-worn, I like that.
Especially with the blinds up here, you get a little John Hanson sweat.
Put some yogurt on it
oh,
to cool it
boy,
off.
Oh, yeah, that's how we do it. Oh, I love that. Normally, the high five still does okay. Because we do the question of the day on my show, and
never
they were like surprised that they even said thank you goodbye. Let's go to Jim. Jim is ready for the high five. Hey Jim, how are you?
I'm doing well.
All right, you're gonna stump the Schwann and John. Are you a big presidential historian nerd?
Well, this kind of stopped me. This was the extra credit question on the sixth grade president's test.
Ooh, okay, I'm ready. Schwann, are you ready to go?
And ready.
I'll tell you the controversy because I got to give you a hint.
Okay.
If you listed the first letter of the last name of all the U.S. presidents, how many letters of the alphabet would not be on that list?
Oh, my God. So, like, Washington would be, like, W... Jefferson
Correct.
Would be J, and Adams would be A, Clinton would be
Correct.
C. So how many are not listed? Okay, what's the controversy Correct. About that and question?
I have to tell you that Van Buren is V.
Oh, not B as in Buren.
Which we all thought.
Oh, you thought Van was his middle name?
Well, we were in sixth grade.
You're right, I shouldn't judge.
Of course, if Dan is the middle, is part of the last name, then Quincy Q should be on the list.
No, but Quincy was a middle name.
Yeah. Well, so was Van.
No, Van Buren is the last
Buren
name.
Van Buren is the full last name.
Think like a sixth grader.
I do that every day, Jim. Okay, so that's a tough question. Did you just like... write them all out on the back of your paper? Because, like, I can't do that without a pen and paper right now and wasting everyone's time to write it all out.
Well, you know, we have, at this point, this is the president's test, so we all have them memorized.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to guess that 13 letters, half the letters, are not represented. Schwann, what do you think?
I'm going to say only 4 or 5.
Really? Okay. What is the answer, Jim? Do you know it?
Yep. It's 8.
Right between us, Schwann. I'm going to call that a win, because if you average our two numbers together, they were correct.
Yeah, what are they? What are they, Jim?
D.
D.
I.
I, yeah.
U.
Q.
This one surprised me. S.
S, yeah, right. Steve, well, yeah. Stevenson lost twice, okay.
U.
U.
And then, of course, XYZ.
XYZ, yeah.
Okay.
This is like the most boring episode of Sesame Street you've ever heard. All right, Jim. Well, you kind of stumped us. Good job, buddy.
All righty.
That's Jim in Tinley
Park. Once again, we learn.
I'm counting that as we got it right. It was right between us, Schwann.
Okay.
That one's hot. That one's.
We'll get half a point.
Jack joins us now from Richmond. Yeah, we got half a point.
0.5 and 1.
The listeners 1.5. Schwann, John half. All right, Jack. You got a quick one for us.
Yeah, who was the only U.S. president to get a speeding ticket?
U.S. president to get a speeding ticket.
Ulysses S. Grant.
Correct. Correct.
Hey, Schwanee. That's a good one.
Pulled over for speeding.
On his horse. On buggy.
His horse. Yes.
Jack thought he had it. Thanks for the call, Jack. No high five for you. And Schwanee, we're tied now with the listeners. 1.5 to 1.5
Hey, we've got 2 hours to go.
Yeah, we got 2.5 Don't shortchange us that half.
I'm trying to get out early.
What are we doing? All right, time for the news on WGN. WGN, John Hanson in for Dean Richards. Just a couple moments, we're going to chat about Ben's in the River, a one-act play celebrating 150 years of life in an idyllic Midwestern town. That town is Riverside. We're going to chat with Jacob Polka in just a moment. He's on the Glazier Players board. And before I wanted to chat with him, though, and I'm sure he can dive a little bit deeper into this, too, Riverside is a community I knew nothing about until a few years ago when I was trying to beat traffic on the way home to Downers Grove from here downtown. The Eisenhower, there was a crash, and I got off at Harlem, and I started heading south trying to kind of navigate the side roads. And all of a sudden, that city grid of right turn, left turn, 90 degrees gave way to this village of only winding roads. Turns out I was in Riverside. And for a TV story I did a couple years ago on our show On the Block, which is a Block Club Chicago show, I chatted with Yvonne Lucero. You'll hear her voice. She's from the Frederick Law Olmsted Society of Riverside. And Aberdeen Marsh Osga, who was a trustee at the time for the village of Riverside, talking about it. You'll hear some background music, too. Remember, this was a TV story that you're now hearing right here on WGN.
People rarely take a shortcut through Riverside more than once, because even folks who've lived here for years find themselves at times confused by where they're going. We have roads that run both north, south, and east and west along their course.
Wait. You have roads that through their course go north, south, east, and west.
Yes. People from the east saw the promise of Chicago, but they didn't necessarily want to dwell amongst its haphazard street plans and dirty air and so forth.
It was designed in deliberate contrast to the Chicago grid, so we do have these curvy streets, and people are a little reluctant to come in and explore.
So they felt that if they had the ability to start over and a guided plan, they could build an ideal community.
From scratch.
Frederick Law Olmsted would always say that the parks were the lungs of the city. He did that because at the time, industrialization in the mid-1800s was booming. It was at its peak, and things were, you know, dirty, chaotic, etc. But he wanted to provide a place for people to come from all walks of life and just breathe clean air.
We recognize him as being our first landscape architect in the United States.
And he said, we're going to design a community. And that's like everything, like the roads, the train station, the plots.
Gas lighting, sewers, running water that would reach the third floor of a home, as well as an appropriate roadway system, walkways, and most importantly, access to open spaces that they could enjoy on a regular basis for just the pure delight of being out in nature.
One of the fun things about doing an interview in Riverside is we have to pause for the train.
I think it's important to note that Riverside's National Landmark designation is based not only on Olmsted's masterful design being the backbone of the community that is still timeless and relevant today, also that Riverside served as a prototype for model rail communities throughout the country. Riverside was studied. It was replicated.
He has a suburb that he designed near Atlanta, Georgia, He designed the Stanford campus, the Capitol grounds, as well as Jackson and Washington parks here in the city.
What is this tower?
This is one of the very most important integral early structures. It's the water tower. It is certainly a landmark in a landmark community, and it's almost everywhere as our logo in Riverside.
It's a freight train! What does Olmsted's legacy mean to you?
That he valued not only green space just for the sake of green space, but for what it could do for people's mental and physical health, their bonds with their neighbors, as well as with nature itself.
Do you think that there's, like me, people who grew up, who have lived in the area forever and had no idea about what Riverside really was?
Everything around every corner is different, and that really, that ability to explore, that really appeals to creative types.
And the legacy also continues not only in the homes, but there's a little art district near downtown with a gorgeous mural.
I mean, if you're going to do something that matters and have it stay that way 200 years later. Riverside is here to stay, and that's why people come here.
Get lost in Riverside.
Yeah!
Visit a local shop.
And you can't be that lost.
We're not saying get lost.
Get lost and enjoy Riverside.
Come and get lost.
I love Riverside. That was a couple years ago TV story I did for On the Block on the U about Riverside. And Jacob Polka now joins us now for the theater portion of this segment. He is from the Glazier Players Board he's a board member there and spearheading the Bends in the River one-act play celebrating Riverside's 150th anniversary August 1st and 2nd. Jacob, welcome to WGN, my friend.
Thank you. How are you, John?
Good. I hope you don't mind me taking the liberty of playing that little TV story.
I'm glad you did, because there is so much history packed in that town, and I was worried I wouldn't remember it all. So you covered it very well. I mean, 150 years, there's a lot to pack in there.
There is. Are you a lifelong Riversider or new to the town?
Yes, I was born and raised in Riverside, and it is much like Mayberry. That's what I joke it's called, because people, they come, they get lost, and they never leave. And then their children come, and they might go off to school and flirt with other parts of the country, but they always return home to Riverside. So it's a very special place, as you've said.
So what's this one-act play all about, then?
So when Riverside turned 100 years old back in 1975, three women put on like a pageant, and they wrote songs, and they put this whole play together about every decade in Riverside's history. And so now we find ourselves at 150 years, and we thought, well, this time around, why not let the residents and former residents and business owners write the story themselves? So we had a bunch of submissions, one-act plays, 10 minutes in total each, and we had about 20 to 25 submissions. We had a committee of Riversiders, past and present, and some who have gone off to New York and are theatrically minded. They read the plays, and we narrowed it down to 8. And so we have really nice one-act plays, 8 slices of life, past, present, and what could be in the future. And they capture life in a small Midwestern town perfectly.
I love that. And I'm now just realizing, as you said, there's 8, that I missed one key word in what I was teasing. It's a one-act play festival celebrating 150 years. Jacob, I would have gotten there eventually. That's awesome. You're doing a bunch of them.
Yes. So there's 8 of them. And of course, we start out with one that's written by one of our residents, Jane Wilhelm. It's very funny. And it's a kind of a spoof on how that map of Riverside that you talk about in your segment, how the winding streets, it looks like somebody took square streets and blew the wind across it. And I mean, as you say, nothing goes north, south, east, west, diagonal, crisscross. You'll get lost. So it's a kind of a funny take on Frederick Law Olmsted. They have an assistant who spills some water on a map. And so it's a funny, funny spoof of how we got our little town plan.
Well, and then I just want to interrupt for 1 second. Sorry. If you look, it was a TV segment, but when I was talking about getting lost there, I found an intersection. I'm sure there's a couple where it's the same road intersecting the same road. So it's a sign, the typical cross sign at an intersection that has the same name on it twice.
Yep, Uvedale Court and Uvedale Road. You pick one and you'll find yourself in the same spot.
So that's one. It's kind of a spoof on how it gets started. And so,
yeah, so then we have, you talked about in your segment about how there's all this this history that even people who live there don't realize all this history. And all of the people, we have eight writers, but then we have eight directors. And then we have a bunch of actors, 27 actors. Whoa. From town and the surrounding communities are involved in all of these little shows. And one of the plays that everybody was surprised to learn about is called The Last Days of the Tudorville Trolley, because Riverside did have a trolley at one point. And a lot of people don't realize that where there's sort of a median going down one of the roads, that covers the trolley tracks.
Was it just inside Riverside?
It was inside Rivers, so it came down to Desplaines, and there's actually, if you look toward Desplaines and 26th Street, there's a what looks like a bus stop is actually the old trolley stop, mm-hmm. and they've just kept it all these years. So it went through Riverside, and then it took a turn. It actually crossed First Avenue on a bridge that's no longer there, and it went to the zoo, the Brookfield Zoo, because we share the Brookfield Zoo with the town of Brookfield.
Wow, that's awesome. So you dive into history that even residents didn't even know about.
Exactly. So we have a little play written by, of course, John Rieger is a very famous Chicago actor, and he wrote one of ours, and his daughter, Allison Rieger Cook, wrote that one about the trolley. So there's a lot of good history, a lot of comedy, and we even spoof ourselves, you know, about the little things that we gossip about in town. So there's something for everybody in our show.
Is Ben's in the River, this festival, just for people in Riverside? Are you encouraging people that maybe know a little bit about Riverside or maybe have never been, use this as an opportunity to jump into town, grab a bite to eat, visit a local business, and learn a little thing or two?
Oh, very much so. We are welcoming. If you can find your way in, it's at the L.J. Houser Junior High Auditorium, 65 Woodside Road, in Riverside, and it's free admission, and so we welcome everybody. And as you say, we have great restaurants, so check out a restaurant. La Barra, Choo Choo are great places to eat before our show at 7:30, and there's ice cream, and of course there's the world famous Aunt Diana's chocolate. So we've got everything there, so we hope everybody from Riverside and the surrounding communities will join us and learn a little bit and celebrate 150 years.
We mentioned the arts district in that story I did. I'm sure that was a couple of years ago. I'm sure it's still vibrant and got some gorgeous murals there too. Does that arts vibe, is that what supports? I mean, these towns don't often have the ability to put on these 8 one-act plays with that number of actors and directors. Tell us a little bit about the Riverside Theater Guild and the Glazier Players.
Yeah, so we've been around for nearly 50 years, the Riverside Theater Guild was started by a gentleman named George Glazier, who was the township supervisor, and his son, Daryl Glazier, was an actor on Broadway. And he came back from stints on Broadway and out in California to direct musicals, and they've been doing them for every summer, every spring, every fall for ages and ages, and now we've evolved, and sadly, Daryl passed away a few years ago, so we started this new company and we named it after him. And the town is full of artsy fartsy people, really. We have authors, we have artists, we have playwrights, as I said, actors and actresses who call it home. It's a very soothing place. It's a very relaxing place and inspiring place to live, so you can see why many artsy people call it home. And, of course, we have Higgins Glass, which is another world-famous place in that art district you mentioned. We are very fortunate that we have all those artsy people. When I started this, I wasn't sure if we'd get all the scripts that we got. I was very concerned. I was worried that my great idea wasn't so great. We were overwhelmed with the support and then from the actors, so it's great.
You should put that on the water tower, a place for the artsy-fartsy people.
That's right. They do project things up there every so often on the holidays, so I'll put that in the suggestion box.
No wonder I felt so at home when I went there.
That's right.
That's great. Got great coffee shops downtown. I mean, it really is.
Yes.
I mean, you're right there on the BNSF line. And like I said, as a kid, I grew up in Downers Grove. I said this earlier in the show, Jacob. Yeah. So like I'd always stop at Riverside and see that old tower just for the moment when you stop on the train. And as a kid, I thought, oh, that looks cool. But I hadn't really gotten out. And It wasn't until I was trying to beat the traffic that I discovered the town. Whether you can make it Friday and Saturday, August 1st and 2nd, to the L.J. Hauser Junior Auditorium, that's great. But, boy, I'd encourage anyone, whichever suburb you're in. We featured you guys on your hometown we do here at WGN Radio, where one day a month we pick a different place around our area. And it was a couple years ago we did Riverside. And I don't know. It doesn't feel like you're in the burbs, which is exactly – how it was designed to be. I mean, that's Frederick Law Olmsted. I talked in the piece about the parks are the lungs, should be the lungs of a community. And you guys really exemplify that.
Yeah. And that you remind me of two other little tidbits that people in Riverside don't realize. One is that if you go along the BNSF, every town, think about it, Downers Grove, LaGrange, everybody, all their businesses face the tracks. We're the only town the businesses don't. You don't see what's there until you get to that water tower. They all face away.
Well, oh, that's quirky.
Part of the plan. Although I'm sure the businesses don't like it.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Back then, you know, it's the focus on the community and the architecture and the plan. And then the other thing is, you talk about the lungs. We have all these little parks, these triangles where the roads meet, and these commons that we call them, these common parks. If you stand, it was designed on purpose so that if you stood on one side on a sidewalk and you looked across, you never saw the road. All these parks come up high enough that you never see asphalt. That was part of the design.
Wow.
So it's all little things like that that make it really, really unique and really special. And we do August 1st and August 2nd as our show, but the town itself has a whole 150-year celebration the next following weekend. We kind of start it, and they ended on the homecoming weekend, August 8th and 9th. And there's a car show, and there's a festival in the park, and there's a concert. So stick around Riverside. There's a lot of good stuff going on in the first couple of weeks of August.
I love it. And drive on through, people. Give a chance. It really is cool. You might get a little lost. You do need the GPS. You don't get the benefit of the grid. And I don't have a compass on my car. This is a separate aside. I don't have a compass on my – it's a three-year-old car. I cannot believe it doesn't have one.
Wow.
Driving that through Riverside, you don't know which direction you're going after a little bit, Jacob.
Right.
I like it.
That's all right. Stop by. We'll find you. We'll rescue you.
Get lost in Riverside, man. Put that on the water tower.
I agree. I think that's a great slogan. I think that's a great idea.
You guys can hire me as a consultant. It's $250 an hour. We'll call that one half hour, Jacob, okay?
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Works for me.
Bends in the River. It's a one-act play festival celebrating 150 years of life in an idyllic Midwestern town. It is Friday and Saturday, August 1st and 2nd at 7:30 p.m. It is free. It's at the L.J. Hauser Junior High Auditorium, presented by the Riverside Theater Guild and Glazier Players. Jacob, great to meet you. I'll see you soon in your town, okay?
Thanks so much, John. We appreciate it.
That's great stuff. And happy 150th to Riverside. You look good for 150 years. If anyone thought I was distracted for a moment, we had an Army helicopter essentially buzz the tower here at WGN. Andy, I don't know if you saw that helicopter a few minutes ago. It was kind of going around Navy Pier. I'm sure it's just some sort of training exercise, or I don't know what it was. But then it flew down the river, probably 400 feet. It's a couple hundred feet from us. Buzz the tower. Okay. If anyone happens to be downtown and you look up, you see an Army helicopter. Nothing to panic about. They're just flying around. Okay, let's take a break. Eli, I think, has a Stump the Schwann and John question on reserve. Schwanny and I are tied with the listeners, 1.5 to 1.5. We'll see who takes the lead next. And we'll get news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN. Andy Mazur, the score of Stump the Schwann and John is 1.5, 1.5, right?
Correct.
And we're just about halfway through the show. Schwanny, we had a listener call in that left a question. Eli is going to read it to us. You ready to go, Schwanny?
Let's go.
This is presidential useless trivia. Okay, go ahead, Eli.
Yeah, this comes from Gary in Mount Prospect. He said there were 5 colleges in America that have produced both a Super Bowl winning quarterback and a president of the United States. Andy, I told you earlier, you might need to help these guys out.
Yeah.
I'll let you guys think about it.
A president and a Super Bowl winning quarterback.
There are 5 colleges, and I'll have a hint for that on the other side as well. Actually, you know what? I'll give the hint now so we have someone to think over.
Yeah, please, please.
Each of the presidents out of those 5 universities only served 1 term.
Oh, okay. That does help.
Hmm.
University of Michigan would be one. Gerald Ford.
Yeah. And Tom Brady.
And Tom Brady. That's one.
All right. Four remaining. So we got one-fifth of a point there, at least.
I'll say you have to get three.
I like that. Okay. Oh, Gerald Ford. I'm just trying to, run through the colleges that presidents went to. A lot of them are, Ivy League, which I would imagine haven't supported
not
too
so
many.
Much Super Bowl winning quarterbacks.
All right, Shwani, you got to do the news here.
Mm-hmm.
Andy, you can help us out with this one too. Yeah. No Googling though allowed. You hear the tone. Time for the news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN.
And Dave Schwann, our reputation hangs in the balance as presidential nerds. Eli, give us the question that we got before the news again.
Yeah, this comes from Gary in Mount Prospect. He said there are five colleges that have produced both the U.S. president and a Super Bowl winning quarterback, and so far we've gotten Michigan.
And we have to get three out of five to get the point. And so you said Michigan, right, Schwani, for Ford?
Yes, University of Michigan, Gerald Ford, yes.
Okay, so I got a second one. Biden went to Delaware, and Flacco went to Delaware. That's got to be on the list.
Joe Flacco did go to Delaware. Okay. That is the number one school on this list.
There's two.
All right, so here's where I'm thinking. Andy, I need your
help.
I think
I have one, yeah.
Okay, well, I know Carter went to Navy, and I bet did a Navy quarterback win the Super Bowl at any point?
Roger Staubach.
Boom, we got
there
it.
There we go.
We got three.
Sorry, wrong noise. Whoa. Wrong noise. I got so
Eli.
Excited. I got so excited.
There it is.
There we go. Yes.
I was like,
you got
man,
it.
Man, Andy.
So, okay, Navy, U of M,
and
Delaware.
And Delaware.
And so there's two more.
I think I got one.
Oh, well, okay. What school?
I think Stanford had to produce a president, right?
Well, that's what I wanted. Stanford was where I went, too. And it has a
John Elway
went there. And I'm thinking, Nixon was a Californian, but he did not go to Stanford.
Yeah, Stanford's got to be one of them.
Stanford is a correct answer. You mm-hmm. have one. They produced two quarterbacks. Elway is one. Plunkett the other.
Yeah, Jim Plunkett.
Okay.
The president.
Did Hoover go to Stanford?
It is Herbert.
Oh,
Hoover.
Boom! And where's this? Wait, no, wait. Where's the sound effect, Eli? Give us the good one. Hold on. Let me say that again. We'll do this better when it's live.
No, play the music that they played when you hit bucket number six on the grand prize game. That's what we need.
Wish I had
here
that one ready. But
on this show,
was it Herbert Hoover? Oh, look at that. That's four.
Wow.
No idea. Another one.
The last one, I mean,
get in the microphone, Eli. You're drifted away a bit.
I can give you one more hint on the last one.
Okay.
Both the president and the quarterback have the same first name.
That's not going to help at all. Okay, hold on.
It is not a power school by any means. If you look at today's college football alignment, it is still in the FBS, but God, it is not a power four school.
Now, I know how people feel with the question of the day that I give every
now, what,
day.
What era of Super Bowl are we talking here?
It was in the 21st century.
Well, hold on. I have no idea the school. I'm just going to Ben Roethlisberger and Ben Harrison? Benjamin?
That is absolutely that correct.
What
Miami
school was
Miami,
it?
Miami, Ohio.
Miami, Ohio. Yeah. Hold on. Let's do that again.
I'm going
ready?
Home.
I am ready.
Was it Ben Roethlisberger and Benjamin Harrison at Miami of Ohio?
I'm going home.
You've gone 5 for 5.
Nice.
Turns out that hint of the first names. Yeah, but the last two were hint driven. We got the good old fashioned way, 3 out of 5.
You got the win fair and square.
Thank you, Andy, for helping us out.
My pleasure.
So that's 2.5 for John, Schwann, and Andy. It doesn't quite roll off the tongue as
no,
well.
No, it doesn't.
And 1.5 for the listeners. So you can get on in here, 312-981-7200. A little later this half hour, we'll talk to Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. We're going to talk about the Superman movie and generally how the box office has done compared to last year. And Dave, you mentioned the heat wave from 30 years ago.
Yes.
Boy. Everyone, if you ask people, what's your memory of that? It's the refrigerated morgues, I would say. That's the thing that I think sticks in our memory the most, at least for me. But what I found fascinating when digging through the Trib from those days was how long it took the city to realize something was really wrong. It was days because there was this lag effect.
There was a very slow response to this.
Insane. And even the way the stories are written about the heat in the early days, I'll tell you what, I'll read some of these articles and headlines just to show you how this just completely caught the city and the country by surprise, the heat wave here 30 years ago. We'll do that next on WGN. On WG. Do you already bump with this song, Eli? Is this a repeat? No, we didn't do this one yet? Okay. All right.
right. 11:13 now on WGN. John Hanson in for Dean Richards. Having a good time this morning. Dave Schwann in the newsroom. Andy Mazur in the sports room. So you got the A team there. And here I am in for Dean. Someone had a really nice thing to say about me. They said they're enjoying the show. And that I'm their second favorite fill-in after Wendy. So there we go.
You're in the top two.
Yeah, I'm in the top two. I appreciate that, Texter. And we all love Wendy Snyder, of course. Hey, before we get to the Chicago heatwave thing, Dave Schwann, we are we're up on the listener now, 2.5 to 1.5 for Stump the Schwann and John. There's two of us, and of course Andy helping out too. So I guess our next
we're going to need you for the duration here.
Yeah, right? Especially if there's any sports connection.
Yeah, absolutely.
My point is, there's the two of us, so why don't two other people challenge us? Norma and Greg are together on this call. Hi, guys.
Yes, we are together on the call. Hi.
Okay, welcome to WGN. Are you guys big historian nerds or presidential nerds?
We are trivia nerds.
Oh.
Presidential nerds. Yeah. We are in Montana, but we are from Chicagoland area. Barrington in Chicago, and we're traveling, and we're listening to you.
Oh, well, thank you for doing that. Is Greg going to say hi to, or is Norma the talker here?
I talked to you before when I had the parrot that painted, and
I remember that, yes.
Months ago.
Oh, okay, that was great.
Our question is, which five presidents had no biological children?
Okay, I know Washington.
Washington did not.
No. And I imagine James Buchanan. He was never married.
That's two.
Presidents without kids. Jackson didn't have any biological kids, right, Norma and Greg?
Jackson.
Jackson did not.
Okay, so we got three. I think that's pretty good, but you want the other two.
What about Hoover?
Now, Hoover had kids.
Did he?
Yes. Okay. I think these are early presidents. Most the ones that I can think of are the modern era.
Right. They're all early presidents.
All right. How about Madison?
Yes.
Good job.
All right. Wow. I got four. I think that's a win, right? Norma and Greg, can you give us that?
Jump ahead a few decades.
Jump ahead a few decades. Okay. Polk?
James Polk.
Yeah. You got it.
Oh. Schwann and John, look at that. 3.5 to 1.5. Even the power couple of Norma and Greg in Montana couldn't stump us. Look, I stood up after that one.
Whereabouts are you in Montana?
Great job. You did it so fast. Thank you. All right. Have a great day.
Hold on. Schwann's got a question. Where are you guys at right now?
Whereabouts are you in Montana?
We've been traveling out west. We were at the Grand Coulee Dam yesterday. We're in Lake Coeur d'Alene 2 days before, and tonight we're going to be in Casper, Wyoming.
Oh, that's a beautiful area. Casper? Yeah, you'll like that.
Are you in an RV, or what are you guys doing?
We just have a little BMW. We stay in hotels.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah, no, that's fine. You don't have to rough
it. That's a terrific road trip. Enjoy it and be safe out there.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's great.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, that's sweet. I love when our listeners carry us with them.
We have the best listeners in the world, John.
We sure do.
Yeah.
But you know what they aren't? Stumping the Schwann and John. After Ron's
not
call,
today.
We come through. I can't believe we got that one. We thought through it. Okay.
I wasn't aware that Hoover had kids, though.
I think he has one.
Just one?
I read his autobiography.
Yeah.
Sorry, we're going down a Hoover tangent, everyone. This is what this show is sometimes when I fill in. Hoover, who, of course, is recognized as a terrible president because of the Depression, and perhaps rightfully so, and his inaction to do anything once it hit later in his term, was an incredible human being, and by all accounts, in terms of his efforts in World War I and afterwards to feed Europe, essentially.
Yes. Yeah. Go ahead, John.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's a very touching story about Herbert Hoover, and of all people, Harry Truman, because right after World War II ended, Truman was aware of what he did, to help rebuild Europe in World War I and so forth. So he called in Hoover, who was, kind of disgraced after the Depression and his one term, and he brought Hoover back to the White House, sat him down and said, I would like you to help us do this and this. And, you know, you've did so much good work there after World War One. The man broke down and started to cry.
Wow. It meant that much to him.
It meant that much to him. And he said, I'm so grateful for you for bringing me in and trying to help here. This is going to help restore my my reputation. He was that moved by it.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. And
it's in a wonderful book about Harry Truman.
I love Harry S. Truman. And the S, of course, stands for what?
Nothing.
Exactly. This is what happens when you put Schwani and I together.
And I imagine you've
are we
been
on the radio
to,
right now?
you've been out to Independence, Missouri.
I've not. No, I've not done the tours like you have. I've not done the traveling like you have.
No. Go, because not only do you see the Presidential Museum, the house is down the street.
That's cool.
And it was, you know, just sparked another memory hearing from our friends in Montana. When I was a kid, we did a major road trip through the western United States and drove through Independence, Missouri. It was 1965, and that meant that Harry and Bess were still living in that house.
Oh, my gosh.
And we went down the street.
And just waved hello?
Well, you could. I mean, he was always out for his morning walk. So,
That's wild. Independence, Missouri. All right, that's where I'll take David on his first vacation. I'm sure he'll thank
me for that. Good choice. That and Springfield. Go see the Lincoln stuff.
All right, kid, your first place. We're going to Springfield Independence. He's going to be like, he's going to be in a Mickey Mouse hat being like, oh, okay. Thanks, Dad. Hoover lived.
No Disney World, you know.
Yes, no, we're going to see Truman's house, kid.
No Epcot Center.
He and Enrique will leave me. Hoover ended up living to the age of 90, I know. Lived, I think until Carter was the longest living president.
He may well have been. After, he was in his 90s. He died, what, 1967, 68?
64, I think.
64, yeah. Okay.
I mean, I think. But I think he has the longest time after a term, because obviously he left office in 33, technically. Oh, boy, I got to stop. 312-981-7200. You call in to stop us so that...
I thought we were going to start talking about Millard Fillmore now.
Oh, no. Well, the things I could say about Millard Fillmore. That's a sentence you didn't hear Dean say on the radio. This will be my first and last, or not my first, but third and last time hosting for Dean. There'll be a special request from Dean himself who's like, what are they talking about? Hey, really quickly, I do want to kind of go through these papers. Just that heat wave of 1995. I always, whenever these big event anniversaries comes up, I like to just go back to the paper of record of the time and see, you know, how did they cover it in that moment? Did it feel as grave in the paper as what was happening? And the very first, second day of the heat wave, Friday, July 14th, 1995, so that was 30 years ago tomorrow, reporting on what happened 30 years ago today, essentially, it had hit 106 degrees at Midway 30 years ago today. It hit 104 at O'Hare for the official high. And here's how the Tribune covered it, through no fault of their own. It's on the left-hand side of the paper, has a 106-degree mark right on it, has a picture of a guy spraying a hose on his face to keep cool. And here's what the reporter wrote about the 106-degree day. This is in the Tribune. It says, from the Department of Scant Consolation, only about 1/2 billionth of the sun's heat and light energy reaches the Earth. The rest of our star's blazing energy is lost in space or absorbed by the other planets in the solar system. That's true day in and day out, but on a day like Thursday, it seems though the sun was focusing all of its searing heat on the Chicago area. It's a well-written couple of paragraphs, and it talks about the temperatures, but it obviously takes a lighthearted approach at what was happening in the city. That was the first day of the crisis. Day two in the Tribune, the lead photograph is one of these Chicago water fire boats that we see often up and down the river, actually watering down the Kinzie Street Bridge. Why? The bridge wouldn't close. This is 30 years ago on July the 15th. The headline read, "Twice Baked Chicago Area Feeling the Strain." It's still a lighthearted article, though. It goes on to say the Chicago area's stiff upper lip trembled a bit on Friday, the second consecutive day of 100 degree heat, as both humans and machines struggled to adapt to life in an oven. But again, there's no mention of heat deaths in the Tribune at all. And so by the 16th, things had actually started to cool down temperature-wise. But
Now people were realizing what had happened. The headline on Sunday, July 16th, 1995, heat wave death toll soars. 56 in Chicago area fall victim even as the temperature dips. The headline, or excuse me, the paragraph, the lead paragraph, Cook County morgue workers have handled airline crashes and large apartment fires, but nothing they say compared to this weekend's unprecedented heat-related death toll. That grim tally reached 56 Saturday night, expected to grow by Sunday's first light. And it did, of course. The lead on the next day, which was Monday, July the 17th, 1995, the headline, Heat Now Being Counted in Bodies, Not Degrees. And there's the first picture of one of the refrigerated morgues on the front of the Chicago Tribune. Death toll of 116 could double. Most area victims are elderly. And then the last one I'll mention was the headline in the paper of Tuesday, July the 18th. Long after now the heat wave have officially left. Casualties of heat, just like most of us. Here's the lead paragraph in that paper. Some died simply because they didn't like fans, didn't want to run their air conditioning, or were afraid to open their windows to the threat of crime that hangs over some neighborhoods like an ever-looming thunderstorm. But they weren't, for the most part, the secondhand victims of loneliness, collapsing in their dark, silent, humid homes because no one cared enough to offer the help that would have saved them. Frederick Wilson Jr. died as an 83-year-old father trying to grasp him in his arms, kneeling next to his bed as if they were uttering childhood prayers. Then, minutes later, the 47-year-old man who became a Christian in his early years, as his mother put it, was taken from the Englewood home where his family had lived for 44 years. Saturday night, he was just one of seven victims that were put in the back of the van. Not to try and bring things down so much, but this heat wave was, as Dave Schwann mentioned, really hit the poorer communities in our city hard, and thankfully has led to a lot of changes, both in not only the cooling centers that Dave mentioned, but the idea of what landlords are responsible for doing and providing some sort of relief from the heat, especially at night, which is really where this heat wave in 1995 did the most damage. Of course, the 106 degrees at Midway stands out, but it was the overnight lows that never dipped below 80 degrees that really, really hurt so many Chicagoans and killed over 700 30 years ago this weekend and week. Okay. Let's take a little break. I think we have one more person that wants to stump the Schwann and John. We'll do that before the news, but after this break on WGN. 1127 on WGN. 630 texted in. I saw Pearl Jam at Soldier Field in 95. Despite the heat wave, they put on a three-hour amazing show. Wow. Well, speaking of three-hour shows on that day, that Midway hit 106 degrees. The Cubs played the Reds, losing 11-5. 30,623 people baking in the Wrigley Field and on the north side. 3 hours and 20 minutes that game. And it did mention in the Tribune about how the umpires and the players had a hard time staying cool. I can't imagine the fans in the center field bleachers in 100-degree heat.
Oof. And somewhere in Glenview, a young Andy Mazur was playing a doubleheader in 16-inch softball.
Oh, no.
That was a lot of fun.
Oh, boy, yeah. Everyone remembers that 95 heat wave, to be sure. All right, it's 3.5 Schwann and John, 1.5 listeners. Tom in Naperville is going to try and stump the Schwann and John. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Gentlemen, how are you? Happy Sunday morning.
You too, my friend. What do you got for me and Dave?
Air Force One takes the president various places. Air Force One has taken off one more time than it has landed. How can this be?
Air Force One has taken off one more time than it has landed. It didn't crash ever.
Oh, because it brought home the body of John F. Kennedy and he was no longer president in 1963.
Tom?
No, because he wouldn't have.
It carried Lyndon Johnson. So
yes,
yeah. Okay. I'm sorry,
But it was the 63 Kennedy assassination that did it.
No,
what was it?
Richard Nixon resigned as president effective at noon,
and then
left the White House. Left the White House, got to Andrews Air Force Base as the president, got on the airplane, made it Air Force One. And as he was flying over the country,
he was no longer president.
Well, yeah.
All right, Tom stumped the Schwann and John.
He got us then.
Oh, three and a half to two and a half.
Point.
Big win for Tom. What's up?
Can I get a Seymour Paisen scarf or something?
You want a scarf?
A Seymour Paisen scarf.
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, are you guys so young?
I'm 40. I don't know.
Wally Phillips used to have
Seymour Paisen scarf. Oh, okay. Well, look what we got in the back. Otherwise, I'll give you a scarf that I've got that I wore to a Bears game a couple years back, okay?
Have a good rest of your day, gentlemen.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
It. All right, time for the news on WGN. Getting a lot of Hoover love on the text line, Dave Schwann. That's good.
Well, he's a Midwesterner.
Yeah, first president born in west of the Mississippi in Iowa. Someone said that they went to the Hoover Museum, and it was a wonderful, beautiful library museum in Iowa.
I was there many, many years ago.
That'll be David's second vacation. Yeah. Just take Interstate 80 West, and it's right off there.
Oh, my goodness. You know what, John? I just thought of this. Next month will make the 60th year since we did that trip, 1965.
Do it again.
Yeah, we're due again. Although we're planning a 100th anniversary trip for Route 66 next year.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Yeah.
That's a good little trip.
Still in the works, but hoping that can happen.
I've made it down as far as Joliet on that trek.
Well, you've not been to Springfield?
Springfield, Illinois?
Yeah.
Yeah, but not on Route 66.
Oh, not on 66. Okay.
I made it as far as Joliet once. I've also seen the end of it at the Santa Monica
Pier. Santa Monica,
which
yeah.
is wacky and weird to think of, but yeah. that's cool.
I know it is, yeah.
I didn't even get... I was there for some... What was I? Some red carpet thing I was doing years ago for TV, and I just went out to the pier, and I'm like, oh... Well, this is where it ends. That's cool.
Yeah, that part of the route from San Bernardino on in, they call that the Will Rogers Highway.
Mm.
Just that section, just named for Will Rogers. No one knows who Will Rogers is anymore. You do.
But, I do, yeah.
Yeah.
Dave, are you available for trivia teams? Like, if anyone out there needs a fourth, are you for hire? I mean, you could charge. I mean, some of these people take trivia so seriously.
I know.
At these bars, you could charge
you
for
know,
it.
Ron Brown here in the newsroom has talked about that. I thought about it and then got busy doing something
life,
else.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, we could feel the good team at WGN. You say Ron Brown's good at the trivia too?
Yes.
Me,
yes.
You, him.
Yeah.
Mazur should be a part of it for
yes.
the sports.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Andy. Thank you. Take then, anybody.
We'll have everything covered except the things that the young people know, like the really young people. Pop culture. Who's going to be our pop culture person? Lapka?
No,
I don't know.
That's a possibility.
That's good. That's
I mean, Dean would know. I mean, who am I taking? Dean. Yeah, Dean would know. Dean's up on all this stuff. All right, so Dean.
He's the oldest of the group, I might add.
Wow.
He's not here.
I'm not going to add a word to that. That
it's
was Dave
battle.
Schwann. Eli, re-rack that and clip this MP3 and send it to
he
Dean.
He hears it every week.
You guys are the best. It's actually really fun to be with you guys here today. When they asked me to fill in, I was not only tickled to just do it for Dean's show, but to be with you too. And you guys appreciate this joining on in and not taking the day off because I was here. That's appreciated. Okay, we're going to take a break. Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. We'll talk about what's in the movies, what's going on there next on WGN. WGN. Happy Sunday morning, everyone. July the 13th. It's John Hanson in for Dean Richards. I do not know the entertainment world 1% of what Dean knows. It's my blind spot if we were to put together a trivia team. That's why we have Dean. That's why this morning we have Blockbuster Blake Stubbs to help me on out. Blake, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, John. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Yeah, I'm doing good here on WGN. You know, I always love being on the 50,000-watt blower, and it's a lot of fun. And you always come on. You were just on with Landecker this week, and you fill in for Dean sometimes, and when Bob's on, and all sorts of things. So your pedigree is well-represented here, and I'm going to you to tell me a little bit about this Superman movie. I know it's out because I've heard Dean talking about it, but, like, how many of these have we had now? Is this the first Superman since the original bunch of movies, or have there been some in between? What's the story on Superman movies?
Okay, so Superman in pop culture can be broken down by just a few different actors for visual representation purposes. There have been television shows. Okay, I know that actor Dean Cain was Lois and Clark's Superman. There has been an era of television in recent years where most of the DC, you know, pantheon of characters have been represented. And offhand, I'm not one who has watched any of those television shows, but I do know that Superman has really never been out of the pop culture sphere. But everything for movie-going audiences started with Christopher Reeve.
Right.
And the run working with Richard Donner and really trying to bring that character to life worked wonders. And for a lot of reasons, every version of Superman that's ever been done since owes a little bit to what they did back with that era of films. There was also the Zack Snyder run of Superman films where Henry Cavill played Superman. And then there's the one, at this point, feels like the lost Superman film, which was Superman Returns, where Brandon Routh played the character. This, however, this new version, 2025 Superman, is a whole lot of movie in one package. Meaning, we have a brand new Superman. We have a whole new creative direction for the DC film. I don't want to call it franchise. I want to say the DC film brand. I don't want to call it a universe yet because we really only have one movie to really judge it by at the moment. And, you know, based on how it does, we will see how things unfold in the coming years. But our new Superman is David Corenswet. Now, that is a name you may not know, John. This is a guy
who's
been working in Hollywood for quite a while. He's done television. He's done movies. This is his big, massive breakout role. And it's one of the most famous roles that anybody could take on. I'm here to tell you, personally, after seeing this movie yesterday, I think he plays this with gusto. I think this is our guy. The reason I'm going to argue that is because the source material, and I'm not a big comic book aficionado, so anybody who wants to weigh in, you know, feel free, put me in my place. But I know that a big inspiration for this film was the run of Superman referred to as All-Star Superman. Both visually, in the treatment of the film, and I believe in the portrayal of the character, Corenswet nails it, and the film's look captures sort of what that book series, I believe it was 12 issues, went for. Now, this is what James Gunn, who has written and directed the film, is basing everything off of going forward. If you know the name James Gunn, you would know that he was the director of all the Guardians of the Galaxy movies for Marvel, which was a huge successful property for them that was considered sort of a like a rogue property. It was never considered one of the main IPs in the Marvel pantheon, but the success there was just unquestioned. And all of those characters ended up in the bigger Marvel, you know, plan in the long term because of that success. He's trying to replicate that, only this time the difference is he's in charge of DC. He's not working for anybody else. He's doing his own thing and leading the charge with this massive film that, by the way, I keep calling it big and massive, but it's only 2 hours and 9 minutes. Usually you'd think a movie like this would stretch 2.5, closer to 3 hours. But no, this tries to remain a fairly tight, yet big and ambitious project. And I think in all of the right ways, the film works.
So I want to ask you, Blake, as someone who doesn't go to a lot of these movies, I mean, I like an action movie like everyone. You know, I love my 1990s action movies. Give me a Clear and Present Danger with Harrison Ford any day. Yes. But I did love the Batman, like the Dark Knight, and that little run, the Christopher Nolan run. Is this in the vein of, you know, like dark backstory and gives us like a deeper, darker look at Superman? Or is this more in the vein of, maybe since you mentioned James Gunn, is it more in the fun-loving action variety or a good mix of both?
It's more of a fun-loving action variety take on the character. Not just the character, but the overall story, because there are other superheroes that appear in this film. It's not just Superman, which to me says that this movie is trying to do three big things. It's trying to make a statement about the direction of DC going forward, both with its tone visually and in the way that it's written. It's also trying to set the table big enough that they can branch outward from here. We already now have been introduced to characters that, and particularly Edie Gathegi's Mr. Terrific is a character that I want to see more of. Now, you may not know who that character is, but if you see the film, I think you and every other audience member is going to like him. The other thing is that it needs to make me believe that plans are in place for this to branch out accordingly. Not to so much replicate what Marvel's done, but to definitely do its own thing with clear direction and you know, comments – in the media about how this is going to go, because this is Gunn pretty much reinventing everything after the success of stepping into the DC world with the television show Peacemaker, which stars John Cena, the WWE star John Cena, who, if you're very if you're looking forward to seeing more of him, they have a new season of that coming out. So like, he started small, and this is his big swing. Hmm. So that, I hope that puts a little more perspective spin, at least, on what this movie's trying to do. And again, like, when you start watching it within the first, I think it's within the first 60 seconds, the movie's not going to give you an origin story. It gives you about 6 or 7 lines of text that give you context, and then you're right into the movie.
All right.
So you're not going to have any time wasted getting started and easing into this world. You're going to be thrust right into it.
All right. Blake, hang on the line here. We've got to take a quick commercial break. More with Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. John Hanson and for Dean Richards here on WGN. Blockbuster Blake Stubbs joining me. We just talked about Superman. Blake, I know what you did. Summer 1997 is coming out, apparently. They're rebooting this?
It's more like a reboot slash legacy sequel, which, you know, we get a lot of those these days.
Speaking of slash, that's a slash with a hook, right?
Yeah, slash with a big hook, big fishing related hook. Yes, I Know What You Did Last Summer is coming back to theaters, but not with the, it's not the re-release of the original film. It is a reboot, which will feature two of the original stars, Freddie Prinze Jr. and Jennifer Love Hewitt. Now, I wish I could tell you a whole lot about this movie and how hyped I am for it and everything. I didn't even know it existed until about 4 weeks ago when I first saw a trailer, and I thought, oh, are they doing like a summer re-release? Like, is that what it is? Because, like, hey, like you said earlier, John, sometimes the 90s movies are just what I want.
Exactly.
And I'll go see them if that's what's happening. No, this is a whole new cast of characters, but even if you read the plot synopsis, it's pretty much the same.
Why make a new movie, Blake?
Because you want to know what I think the real answer
is?
Yes. The real answer is a studio owns the rights to something, and if they don't make something within a certain window of time, they might lose those rights. Huh. So get some writers in a room and cook up a reboot, and if we can get a little financing together, we can get some legacy stars to come in and hopefully carry this thing. I tell you what, the one franchise that I think did an okay job with this type of thing was the Scream franchise. I have my issues with what they've done in the recent iterations, but the most recent film that came out, I thought, you know what, they're actually
they're trying,
like, sort of the tone and the flow of how this is supposed to go. But really, the magic, I think, is not so much always in the stars, although I'm always thrilled when Neve Campbell shows up in a Scream film. It's really Wes Craven. Wes Craven was the secret sauce that always made those movies work. And with his passing many years ago, you know, at this point, when studios or if someone owns the rights to something, they have to keep making it or else they don't get to do that anymore.
So I know what you did last summer, 1997. I remember that year because it was actually my first date. I brought my girlfriend, Shannon, to go see I Know What You Did Last Summer. And it didn't work out for many reasons with
yeah,
her.
Obviously. Yeah,
with her, it didn't quite. There's a lot of reasons why that our listeners know. But I remember seeing I Know What You Did Last Summer in 1997. I will not be making the. Enrique and I will not be going to the 2025 film, is what I'm saying, Blake.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that the movie will still bring in decent box office.
I'm sure.
I know there are a lot of horror fans out there who just want to see a horror movie every weekend, and they will go. The other big movie, though, that I'm really looking forward to that I wouldn't even call, I shouldn't have said big movie. I should say a movie that I think is going to sneak up on people, is Ari Aster's Eddington, which stars Joaquin Phoenix, Pedro Pascal, and a host of other actors, including, I believe, Emma Stone. And the thing about this particular movie is that it takes place in 2020, and it's about a small town sheriff and a mayor going head-to-head in the public media, and it turns into a sort of neighbor-versus-neighbor scenario.
Huh.
Now,
is it about
honestly,
COVID?
Well, I don't fully know what it's about, because Ari Aster's films don't reveal too much in their trailers. I mean, this is the guy who made Midsommar, which is a movie that if you walked in and thought you were going to get what you saw in the trailer, you got something totally different, and it was a ride. So I know that this particular film has been on my radar strictly because of, one, Ari Aster, but also the actors involved. which is wild to think, John, because if Eddington's coming out this week, the following week, you're going to have Pedro Pascal again on the big screen leading Marvel's big entry this summer, The Fantastic Four, First Steps. So we're sort of flush with opportunities to go to the movies this summer, and the box office for the year has been very good, showing great growth.
That's nice.
I would highly recommend that if the weather gets hot, go to a movie.
Yeah.
If you got kids at home, you got three big options right now. I just said this with John the other night when I was on with Landecker. You know, Lilo and Stitch, Elio, and How to Train Your Dragon. Two live-action remakes and an animated film. The kids are not going to have to be left at home for this.
I'm taking David to Eddington.
As you should. He needs to get a good start and understand how the world works. Yes. And if anyone's going to tell him, John, it's Ari Aster. I'm here to tell you. So
before I let you go, Blake, they're going to re-release Jaws on Labor Day?
Yeah, August 29th, there will be a re-release of Jaws, both, I believe, on 4DX, IMAX, and standard screens. And like I've said to you many times, if you and I are on the radio together, we have to talk about Jaws.
Got
to
mention it.
Well, they're doing it for us, and we're getting a chance to actually speak about it. Yes, Jaws will get a re-release. It's very impossible, I think, every year to do it on July 4th, which would be the most apt time to do it. But July 4th is a big movie-going weekend, and all the newer properties are going to take over. So what they've done is they've shifted everything to Labor Day to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the film's release.
Yeah.
Which, hey, for all the blockbuster talk we're talking, that's the original blockbuster. So August 29th.
John Williams did some trivia about Jaws, and he had me on the air to talk about something else, and he started asking me trivia questions about Jaws, and I don't think he knew what he was in for, having seen the movie so many times on my grandmother's Betamax, and also it was the first DVD I bought back in the day, and I watched the behind-the-scenes special so many times it scratched the DVD. Great movie, and of course you and I watched that many times throughout college with a couple cocktails. Mm-hmm. All right, Blake, that's going to be it, my friend, for today. I appreciate you hopping on, okay?
Thanks very much. Always a pleasure. Have a great one.
Yeah, take care. That's Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. You hear him frequently here on WGN Radio. Okay, tell you what, in the 12 o'clock hour, I'm excited. Bob Bertog's going to join us. You hear him with John Williams taking your calls. We'll take them too. 312-981-7200. You can get on the line now. Is something weird happening in the lawn? Is that tree not looking good? Is that bush not doing great? You find out why. 312-981-7200. He'll be on after the 12 o'clock news. And then I'll give you a recipe a little bit later in the hour as well, as Dean always does. It's Dean out today. John Hansen filling in. News next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN. By the way, it's 3.5 to 1.5. No, excuse me. Thank you. Eli was quick to tell me I was wrong. 3.5 to 2.5 is the score. Andy would have had it if I let him chime in.
Gotcha.
Schwanee and I leading the listeners and Stump the Schwan and John. What that means for those that are just joining us, John Hansen, by the way, in for Dean Richards. Dave and I are political and presidential nerds. I mean, really to a degree that's unhealthy, Dave, would you say?
Well, a little strange.
Off-putting to our friends and family, and maybe some listeners too. But anyways, you can put us in our place. We are currently leading the listener.
A couple people have.
Oh, they sure have.
Yeah.
And if you stump us on a presidential trivia question, you get a point for the listeners, and we'll see who wins by the end of the show, which ends at 1 o'clock. We're going to have Bob Bertog on in a moment. He's going to take your calls and questions about lawns and landscaping. So there's going to be time in the second half hour for you to stump the John and Schwan before the end of the show. Let's have the listeners try and beat us, Dave, as best
okay.
as they can try.
Already.
We won last time, but it was, I think, by the final question. Or maybe we lost. I don't really remember. But point is, call on in now. You could either leave the question with Eli and the answer, and he'll deliver it, or you can hang on and do it after the 12:30 news. And Schwanee, just continue to read those encyclopedias you have along the wall there, too. Dave brought in all 26 volumes of the Britannica from 1989.
You know what we had in our family when I was a kid? Again, grateful thanks to my father. The World Book Encyclopedia.
Does not surprise me.
World Book Encyclopedia, and let me tell you, I devoured them. The really great thing about them was that every year you could buy a yearbook, which was a recap of the previous year.
Wow.
So they would put it out, you know, from 1970, let's say, there was a recap of the year 1969. Anything you wanted to know, sports, music, of course, politics, timely news of the day. It was amazing. Just amazing.
I'm amazed that in Back to the Future that it wasn't actually 26 volumes of an encyclopedia instead of a sports book that he sent back and to read about.
There was something like maybe 21 or 22 because they would combine the letters X, Y, and Z.
You're right.
You know?
Mm.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, this is a real aside. And then Bob Bertog's like, please talk to me at some point. He's hanging on the line. I've always wondered in Back to the Future 2, the complete scorebook from 1950 to 2000, the sports almanac. Andy Mazur, that thing looks like a pamphlet.
Yeah,
how did they fit all those scores in there?
Small font.
It's very small font with a magnifying glass.
Microscopic.
People always try to point out the flaws in the movie of moving through time. I'm like, no, the biggest flaw is the size of the almanac.
You're okay with the flux capacitor, but
I believe 88 miles an hour, certainly that sends you back in time. Putting garbage in to feed it, totally fine. That is not the size of an almanac. Okay, Bob Bertog next. We already have Rose. Oh, look at that. Rose is her name, and she's got a question about something happening in her yard. We'll get to those next, and your calls, too, on WGN. Oh, Miley Cyrus. I won't sing it, but it's about flowers, which leads into our guest. Nice pick there, Eli. Doing a great job producing today. Bob Bertog joins us now. I was lucky enough to steal him from John Williams here this morning. Bob Bertog, of course, the president of Bertog Landscaping Company, and he's going to be out this Saturday, next one on July 19th, at Lurvy Home and Garden with Lou Manfredini taking questions. Hey, Bob, welcome to WGN this Sunday afternoon.
Hi, John. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I did clear this with John Williams, so I'm not stealing a guest, and we're not encroaching on each other's territory, my friend.
Right. Got it.
Well, you help out with so many people. Before we get to Rose and then Lisa, really quickly, the event on Saturday, give us a little bit of the who, what, where, when, how, why, what you're going to be doing there.
Sure. It's at Lurvy's Garden Center. It's in Des Plaines. It's at the intersection of Dempster and Potter. And we're going to be there. Lou's going to be running his show there from 6 until 10. And I'll have my team on site doing a consultation, design ideas. There's going to be, I have one of my people that knows, does colorful pots. We're going to do potting demonstrations. And then I'm going to be on air with Lou from 9 until 10 taking questions.
I love that. So they can see you and some of the stuff that you're doing from 6 to 9 a.m. on site. And then you'll be on the air 9 to 10.
Correct.
Okay. I love that. We'll mention that again here before the end of the half hour to make sure people got it. But I do want to get to the phone lines because you know you get a lot of calls, Bob. Let's go to Rose. Hi, Rose.
Hi, John. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Rose.
Hello. What do you got for him?
Okay, Bob, I have this horrible tree. It's in our neighbor's yard. It's a backyard neighbor. He has a tree of heaven. And all the neighbors around, surrounding his yards, we all have these little trees popping up all over our lawn.
Ugh.
I mean, I go out every single day and pull these little trees out. I can tell you, I could pull 20 to 50 in a little bit of time. Our shed is in the back there. There must be 50 trees popping up through the floorboards in the shed. And my husband just went out and cut down a tree that was coming through the fence. It was probably about 5 foot tall. So if you don't get these things, they really grow, you know. So we're just wondering, is there any way to help us out with this? I mean, I think it's got a totally, really extensive root system under all of our lawns, and that's got to be part of the problem, but it's just the most annoying thing ever.
I hear you, Rose. Bob?
Usually what the seeds are germinating, it's not like they're getting shoots off the roots, but they are. It's very invasive, and a non-selective herbicide will work in areas like where the shed is and stuff, but don't use that if they're coming up in your turf. To come up in your turf areas, you should be able to get it with the selective herbicide, and it's just going to take repetitive things, and eventually the tree will not continue to grow. It's just going to be a slow death.
Okay.
All right.
It's a huge tree, and we're just, you know, you said the word invasive, and that's what we kind of think it is. We're trying to see if we can do anything about that with that it's being an invasive tree. So.
Can you get all just to get together and pay for the neighbor to remove it?
Well, we have done that, and he refuses. So,
okay.
It's providing shade.
You could always check with your village too. That
we have been doing it. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, Rose.
Well, thanks so much for your help.
Yeah, of course. I love a good alliteration. We're going to Lisa in Lombard. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, John. Hi, Bob.
How are you?
I mean, I don't have to wait until Wednesday. I'm good. So I have a weed, a tall spiky weed that if it gets tall enough, it branches out to yellow flowers, and then they get cotton and they blow away. How the heck do I get rid of those? Do you know which weed I'm talking about? It gets pretty tall. It gets about 3-4 foot.
I don't off the top of my head. But again, a non-selective herbicide will knock it back. And if it's growing, is it growing in the lawn or is it in an area where you can
In the
spray?
Lawn, in my garden, in my backyard, backyard, yeah. Everywhere now. It's all over the place. It's really spiky, like a thorn bush, but with a million thorns on it.
Is it easy to pull out, Lisa, or no?
It is very easy to pull out. The problem is there are so many of them. I can't get them all. I mean, there's a ton.
Oh, wow.
So what you can do is a trick that we've taught, I've told on John's show before, is you take put on a rubber glove and then take one of those like waxing mitts like you use for a car, and you put the herbicide on the waxing mitt, and then you just kind of massage the weed, and then the herbicide will translocate into the weed and then out into the root system. Other than that way, you're not going to kill their desirable grasses. You know, is it tedious? Yes,
right.
A little bit, but you'll eventually get it eradicated by doing it that way.
Okay.
You just got to stay on it, Lisa.
I know.
It's
Thank you
worst.
So much, guys.
Yeah, take care.
Yeah.
I know that's, Bob, that's probably like the answer always with weeds. You just got to be on it. I just feel like, and we experienced this in our yard, although I feel like we're getting better at it because the more you're on it, the better it is the next year. I mean, it's kind of small improvements, but year after year, we've gotten a little bit more aggressive with just ripping these weeds out all over the place. And I feel like after 2 or 3 years now, we're finally starting to see a noticeable difference. Do you hear that a lot? Oh, I just turned off Bob's microphone. Sorry. Bob, pretend that I didn't make that mistake. Go ahead.
Yes, we do hear about that. And the thing that people need to understand, too, with the weeds in the turf, the best deterrent for weeds in your turf is a good stand of turf. So if you take horticultural practices and fertilize and water correctly and mow your turf, those weeds have a hard time coming through the turf. So focus on not just necessarily eradicating the weeds, but to focus on horticultural practices that will give you a better stand of turf.
Okay. 773, can you ask Bob how to get rid of Joe Pye and milkweed? Do they attract rats? That's from Marlene.
Well, milkweed is a desirable plant for native plantings because it attracts butterflies. So it's a pollinator. So that's one that I wouldn't tell your neighbors you're doing that. And the same thing with Joe Pye. Those are used in pollinator gardens. So in butterfly gardens, people use them. But again, a weed is anything that's undesirable in your garden can be considered a weed. So you can either use a non-selective herbicide or just mechanical removal.
I've got a personal question, Bob, if you don't mind. We have one area of our garden that is pretty dry. It's along the house, so I don't want to plant too much stuff over there, of course. I don't want to have to be watering right next to the foundation. But anything, we have a pretty large overhang of the roof. So I put like a dwarf, it's a juniper or an Alberta spruce, I think it is. It's a small one. But it just doesn't get as much rain because it doesn't get as much rain. It started getting brown spots. Have I just put it in the wrong place, Bob, and I need to finish it up, or do I need to give it some solid water here for a couple of weeks before I give up on this thing?
Did you just plant it this year?
So we planted it about 2 months ago.
Yeah, evergreens typically don't like a ton of water, but it's the way you're describing it. There's not getting any water. Yes, you're going to have to get it some water.
Yeah, I mean, I watered every now and then, but I thought the rain would get more, and I also put a sprinkler that covers part of the garden, but it's kind of in the back of it, so I just don't know if it's getting enough saturation.
Well, that was going to be my next question. If it's losing the needles on the backside of it against the foundation or against the wall, it needs sunlight. So that's part of the problem, too. Evergreens need sunlight for their needles to grow.
On all sides?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that could be the problem. I just maybe have to move it to save this thing. That's fine. I'll do that. Let's go to Lynn. Lynn's got a question. Lynn, you're having some weed problems, huh?
Yes. You name the weed, and I have it all over. I did put an application down early May, but everything is out of control. Is it too hot to put any type of application? And if I can, what do you suggest?
Well, there's a couple of things. Yes, right now in this heat, it's dangerous to be applying herbicides, but read the label. Most of them typically say to not spray anything over 80 or 85 degrees, because what happens, especially a non-selective herbicide, it volatilizes the and it turns into a vapor, and then the wind will blow it in onto desirable plants. So you have to be very careful when it's this hot and humid, because the way the chemical volatilizes, it's not good for your desirable plants. But so watch the weather, and yes, that you can still eradicate now, but the best time to really eradicate weeds is when they're flowering. So like dandelions, the best time to get them is when you see the yellow flowers everywhere. They will take up the herbicide, though, when they're not flowering. It's just a much longer process and a lot slower.
Okay, that was Lynn. Let's go to Marie. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I'd like to know if I can have my son put grub control down now, or is it too hot?
Usually this time of year, you're kind of missing the window, but we did have a late start into the spring. You can still put down a preventative, you get much better luck with granular, because it gets down into the thatch layer, and then as the grubs come to the surface to feed, they get intercepted by the insecticide.
Okay, the granular. And does that have to be watered in? Does it have to rain right away?
It has to be watered in for it to be effective, yes.
Okay. And it's not too hot right now, right?
No. You should be fine with the grub control.
Unless it's too hot for you, Marie, then make your son do it, okay?
There you go.
It's pretty hot, but I got a new air conditioner last week.
Oh, that's good. Still, make your son go do that. You've earned that.
That's right. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marie. I appreciate that. Bob, question from the 773. Fertilizer, is it really worth it? That's a real general question, but I hear you recommend it a lot, and some people still never go buy it.
Well, let me ask you this. Food, is it really worth it?
Yes, Bob. Okay, fine. You're right.
Yes, it's worth it.
Is it worth it to, this is a follow-up on me, is it worth it to really understand the different types of fertilizer? Because you see them advertised like, this one's good for shrubs, this one's good for trees. Should we pay attention to those specific things, or does a general fertilizer work?
No, a general good balanced fertilizer is fine. Just read the label. And if you do want to limit the amount of fertilizer you want to do, the most important one to do is the one in the fall. So if you're going to skip anything, skip the spring and summer, but don't forget the fall one, because what that does is it sets up the plants for the winter, stores the carbohydrates, so they survive the winter and grow in the spring.
708 wants to know, please ask Bob if there's anything that can be done about the invasive spread of suckers from a black locust tree that are all over our yard. We cut them down to the base. They just keep growing back stronger and stronger every year.
If the suckers are coming off the roots, and it's your tree, if you use a herbicide, you could damage the tree. Really, the only thing to do is just keep cutting them mechanically.
Okay.
That's, unfortunately, is the worst part about it.
They say it's a tree that the village actually planted on the parkway, and they refuse to take responsibility for it. Nothing seems to be working. Well, I don't know. Keep calling them. Don't pay your taxes, 708, and see what happens then. That's not official Bob Bertog advice. That was John Hansen saying that. And obviously, I was kidding. You know we're going to get a letter about that, Bob. Okay. We're going to continue our alliteration role here. You can put her on hold, Eli. I'll go ahead and get Laura from Lincolnshire on right now. Hi, Laura. How are you doing? You're on WGN. Oh, not quite yet. We're going to put her on hold. And there we go. Laura from Lincolnshire. Hi, how are you?
Hi. What alliteration.
I love
anyway,
it.
Anyway, okay, here's the problem. Several years ago, I removed some Bradford pears, and my neighbor still has some, and I have those horrible runners, and I'm tired of just cutting them off at the base. So what I'm thinking of is getting down to where the main root is and actually taking my hatchet, my axe, and trying to cut through. Mm. Is that going to be helpful?
Now, did you say it's your tree or your neighbor's tree?
Well, my trees are gone. And my neighbor's tree is still there, but I have a feeling that because...
Wait, are you talking about taking your hatchet to your neighbor's tree?
No.
Oh.
No. Just okay. What I'm talking about is that when I try to remove the shoots or whatever you call them, you know, you get down, they're attached to a large root that's maybe 4 or 5 inches under the surface. And so I'm thinking I could dig down and cut it. And I don't know if that's just going to make it, you know, sprout out a lot more.
it's going to seek revenge.
That will eventually eradicate them. The roots are decomposing, but they send out shoots or suckers as they're decomposing. But yeah, if you want to go through the labor of doing that, it'll absolutely get rid of them.
Laura, I don't want to encounter you on a dark and scary night with a hatchet, I'll tell you that much.
But that's one of the things. It's like my neighbors really stay away from me more when I do stuff like that.
Oh, thanks, Laura from Lincolnshire. Okay. Oh, that's a good place to end, Bob. One more time, the event this Saturday. Give it a plug.
It's at Lurvy's Garden Center in Des Plaines, Potter and Dempster. And Lou Manfredini's going to be running his show from there from 6 until 10. I'll have my team there to answer questions, and then I'll be on the air with Lou from 9 until 10.
And we'll hear you on John this Wednesday, I'm sure?
Yes.
Okay, you can return back to that where the callers aren't having hatchets wheeling against their plants, but that's what how we do it on a Sunday morning, Bob. Take care, my friend.
Okay, thanks, John. Take care.
All right, let's take a break. And we got news and maybe Stump the Schwann and John. I got a recipe or two for you, too. John Hanson in for Dean Richards on WGN. Apparently, our rat numbers are going down, by the way. I don't know if you saw that story or told that one, Dave Schwann. But
what numbers?
The number of rats in Chicago.
Oh, the rats. Okay.
The calls?
And it's funny because, well, I've seen more recently.
Oh, really? Well, yes. They're all going to you. In the city or in the burbs?
Oh, definitely in the city.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you're the only one. Everyone else is reporting huge drops in the number of rats that they are seeing in the city. They do 311 calls.
They all left elsewhere and have come into my neighborhood.
Yes. I heard Schwanny's house is open for business. What are you putting out at night to feed them, Schwanny?
Nothing.
Okay. There was one little quote from the Chicago Tribune article about this that I found fascinating. They say that the number of rats, we've been consistently called the rattiest city in the United States.
Yeah.
We've won that title a couple years in a row, which, hey, we'll take any first place we get in Chicago. But apparently rats affect mental health. There's a team of scientists that have found through surveys that people who report daily rat sightings, they are 5 times more likely to show signs of depression from other people. And then I thought, well, maybe the people that see more rats, I don't know, is there a connection to income and other things along those lines, and that could lead to it too. No, they did a double blind survey where they actually sorted out for demographic factors like income and race and neighborhood, and found that if you compare similar people from the same income brackets, same race, same religion, whatever, the scene of the rats every day is a marked difference in your depressive nature. Isn't that crazy?
That is.
But I mean, I guess it's like every day if you see them, they have some effect on your mental
health. Well, if it's a daily thing, yes.
That's what they say.
You know, it's not daily. You know, I see them once a week, perhaps, or once every 10 days. And, you know, an L stop or something like that, or in an alley.
But I saw one as big as a rabbit once that really kind of freaked me out for
I've
a couple days.
I've seen them that big. That can startle you, yes.
Yeah, that one creeps into your dreams a little bit. And gnaws at you. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so good news. Apparently rat numbers are going down for everyone except Dave Schwann. Dave, I know Sylvia's got your 1 o'clock. Do you have time for a stump the Schwann if we get one more? You got to go, buddy.
We can do it here in, you know, the next 5-10 minutes.
Okay, yeah. I'll do that. All right. Yeah. So right now is your opportunity to stump the John and Schwann. Your last opportunity. Currently, Dave and I are winning 3.5 to 2.5 against the listeners. So if you got a useless piece of presidential history, and I'll just open it up to American history, Dave Schwann, why not? 312-981-7200.
Yeah, we're still in July, right?
We're still in July, so we're on theme here. If you can stump me and Dave Schwann, you're going to get a high five from us. I know that's not the prize you all want, according to some of the listeners who have called in and then found out that was the prize and hung up. But if you want to call in and stump the John and Schwann, now is your chance. Schwanny's got
to
go.
I have to tell that story to Dean next week.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody called in wondering what the prize is. You said nothing, and they said never mind.
Click. They said, here's the sound of a dial tone, buddy. All right, I got some phone lines hopping on, so you can too. And then I'll give you a little recipe. I know Dean does a lot of the cooking, of course. He does it way better than I do it, amongst other things. But I do have a thing or two I've picked up that I want to share with the listeners. After this on WGN. Call 40. WGN. 20 more minutes of myself, John Hanson, filling in for Mr. Dean Richards. Before we get to two Stump the Schwann and John questions, 773. Can you tell me, I'm reading this in a sassy voice, I don't know if this is what the texter wanted, but can you tell me exactly how rats are counted and exactly who determines the rattiest city in the U.S.? Is it the Federal Rat Agency that does the count in every city in the USA, so Chicago is determined to be the rattiest? No, texter. It's done by, of course, a company. It's done by Orkin. They do the data. They collect the rankings. They track their residential rodent treatments over a year period. And then they release it to the public. And we publish it because it's news and it's interesting to people. But then, of course, it's a plug for Orkin as well. So they are smart to do that. But no, there is no federal rat agency. And we don't count them by... I mean, Dave Schwann counts them in his neighborhood every day. And he reports them to the federal rat agency. But he's the only one that calls. And he's the only one that has the number. All right, Schwanee, we're up.
I'm ready.
2.5. No, we're up 3.5 to 2.5. So two calls means that if we get stumped twice, we lose. Unless anyone else comes to our rescue with a call as well. 312-981-7200. We're going to start with Jeff on the Northwest side. Hello, Jeff. How are you?
Gentlemen, top of the morning to you. Well, good afternoon, really.
Yeah, right. Both of them. We'll take them. All right, Jeff, you a nerd historian here too, like us?
A little. I don't have the track record this morning that you folks did. But,
I like that.
Only president never to be married.
Oh, James Buchanan.
I
learned that years ago on Welcome Back, Cotter.
There you go.
That was Buchanan High School.
Nice. That's okay. That's a good question. It's just one that happened to Schwanee and I happen to know. So thanks for calling, Jeff.
Well, thank you. You gentlemen, enjoy your afternoon.
Thanks for calling.
Let's make this one worth 2 points, Dave.
I've got a question when we're done.
Yeah. All right, okay. Let's go to Chris calling from Chicago. Hi, Chris. How are you?
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on the World's Greatest News.
Absolutely. Well, World's Greatest Newspaper, but yeah, it's the same thing. What do you got for us, Chris?
What U.S. states are further south, north, east, and west?
Okay, so a little geography here. All right, south, west.
That's right.
I feel like there's a trick coming here. Schwanee, let's just talk through it out loud. We're not giving you our official answers, Chris. We're allowed to think out loud. East, are we going Maine or Florida, Schwanee?
I'm going to go with Maine.
That's what I'm thinking, but let's hold off. South, got to be Hawaii, right?
Yes.
Now, west.
Correct.
Thank you. West. My inclination is Hawaii, but I wouldn't be surprised if you look at the lines of longitude, if some of the Alaskan islands go a little further west. You want to go with Alaska?
Yes.
Let's go Alaska.
Yes.
Correct.
For west. And then Alaska's got to be north, right, Schwanee? I can't think of it.
Right, absolutely.
Alaska north?
Correct.
All right, so then that leaves us with east. So Schwanee... Maine or Florida? This is for the ball game. You want to go Maine?
I'm going to go Maine.
We're going to go Maine, Chris.
The Aleutian Islands of Alaska go across the international dateline, making Alaska the east.
You have got to be kidding me.
Your producer knew that. The producer knew that, and he didn't give me
What are you trying to rub some extra salt in the wound here? Eli, you knew it was east. Was that too as well? Your mic's not on, buddy.
I could sense the trick coming a little bit, but I might have sniffed it out.
I don't know how I feel about what just happened, Dave Schwann. Chris, that's a great question. Congratulations. You get a high five from us.
Now, here's my question.
Okay. Well, yeah, I just want to make sure. Do we buy that argument, first of all, Schwanee, that it is, since it's over the dateline, further east?
Technically, right. And you could go with... some of the islands that aren't states, but there are, you know, in the Philippine area there that U.S. territories.
It was territories.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we still won 4.5 to 3.5. So,
well, Eli is a very sharp young man here. And I've got
to turn on the microphone a couple times, so let's not extend it too far. but
can I submit my trivia application at least?
Yeah, you're on the team.
Here's a question. And John, I know you're going to know this.
Okay.
I have no doubt you will know this.
Well, that's pressure.
There are two presidents that have served non-consecutive terms. Who are they?
Grover Cleveland.
And?
Donald Trump.
There you go.
Yeah, that was a good
one. I said you would know it. I was waiting for Eli to come.
Do you know who?
I had it ready.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, that was for Eli. Sorry.
It's all right. He said he had it ready. So,
who served between the two Cleveland terms? That's for Eli. Basically, I just want to prove that I know more than Eli.
Was that Benjamin Harris?
Dang it. Yes, it was. Who was the grandson of?
William Henry Harrison.
Yes.
The shortest presidency.
I do have one more. It's kind of like a list one if we can try to knock out some of the lists.
Okay.
I have a list in front of me. There are seven presidents who are left-handed. Can you try to get
seven of them?
Seven. That's a good number.
Well, one. Let's see. Two of them.
Four.
Two of them were. The one was George Bush, W. Bush.
Was he a lefty?
H.W.
Bush
is the one we were looking for.
And I think Bill Clinton was left.
That's two of them.
Oh, I can picture his thumbs up with his left hand. Yeah.
You've got two.
Reagan?
Reagan's a third. One more for the win.
Okay. Reagan.
Ronald Reagan was left-handed?
Eureka, I guess so.
The article I'm looking at said that he was born left-handed, but when he was a kid, he was instructed to use
that
his
was
right hand.
In that generation, they forced him to be right-handed, yes. Mm.
Okay, so Clinton, H.W. Bush, and Reagan. Oh, first of all, that's three consecutive lefties that served. The fourth one. That's true. Boy, I'd be taking a shot at the dark with any of them.
I would be also.
Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. I wonder if he wrote it with his left hand. Do you want to go with it?
That would be incorrect. I mean,
I didn't say final answer.
Well,
I'm just kidding.
It said it would be.
Oh, wait. He was a lefty or no?
It said it would be an incorrect answer.
It would be incorrect. Okay. Sorry, Eli's doing like 10 things at once, which is why he jettisons off the microphone every now and then.
Doing my best.
You're doing your best. No, you're doing great. Okay. Who can you give us the... Do you have any last guesses, Shwani?
No,
I can hear radios clicking off as we do this segment longer. All right, who are the other lefty presidents?
We were looking for James A. Garfield.
Okay.
Harry S. Truman.
Oh, Truman.
Gerald Ford. And Barack Obama.
Oh!
Barack Obama was...
We should have gotten that one.
We should have, sure.
Oh, man. Do we even finish the show at this point? Just do 13 minutes of silence of shame.
We'll just continue this on the podcast that we always talk about doing.
You drove by Truman's house when he was alive. He didn't wave at you with his left hand, Shwani, and you didn't know that?
No. We did in 1965, and he died in 72, I believe.
He was also the first holder of a Medicare card, wasn't he? I believe so.
I think he was. Yes, right.
Yeah, right. Medicare. We got one last submission here that is going to be coming in on the line. This is Al for a chance to give the listeners a tie. Al, you're in Riverview. What's your question?
Yeah, guys. Who is the only president to meet George Washington and Abraham Lincoln?
He met Washington and Lincoln, and he was a president.
Yes, he was a president.
John Quincy
Adams?
That would
be my guess. He lived a long time. Let's go with it.
John Quincy.
Shwani.
John Quincy Adams was right in between and then met both of them.
Oh, sixth president, right? Yeah, right before Jackson. Yeah, there you go.
Right before Jackson and Van Buren. Right
before Jackson and Van Buren, which is the whole last name is Van Buren. His middle name was not Van.
Not Van, right.
Dutchman. He was a Dutchman.
He was. And I think Van Buren was the first president born in the United States of America. The rest of them were
as a United States citizen.
As a U.S. citizen.
I think that's correct. And he was also featured on Seinfeld for the Van B Boys, the gang from Bronx.
He also had these great sideburns, too. If you ever see a picture of a president that has sideburns, the answer is Martin
Van Buren.
He's
got them,
yeah.
Very presidential.
Very good. Al, thank you for the call.
Yep, thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Al.
We are winners. Good stuff there.
Yeah.
All right, good. Thanks for sticking around a little longer, Shwani.
Sure. Oh, yeah. You know I'm always ready for this.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. Tell you what, why don't I take a break right now, and then I've got a recipe or two. And also, if you've got something interesting you want to cook up today, you got a quick recipe for the listeners. I don't know if Dean ever opens this up to everybody, but let me know. What are you cooking tonight? 312-981-7200. I'd love to hear from you. Let's spark some ideas for what's for dinner, what things to cook during the week. I'll give you one suggestion, too, next on WGN. 1253 WGN. I like listening to these instrumental versions. It's good. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Sylvia Snowden sitting down. She'll give us the 1 o'clock news in a little bit, which means that Stump the Schwan and John is over. The final score, 6.5 for Dave and myself versus 4.5 for the listeners, I believe was the final score. And that means Schwani and I won. You did not stump us. Next time I fill in here, if I'm on with Dave Schwan over the holidays or something, we'll play it again. Or he's in sometimes for Mr. Grzanich, and I'm in for Mr. Bob sometimes. So we'll do it again some other time. 312-981-7200. If you got any other thoughts or interesting questions about trivia or otherwise, I'll take them. Also, what are you cooking tonight? I love inspiring people and getting inspired by all the recipes that Dean provides on Channel 9 and here on this show. I don't know if he's shared one before about a smoked salmon or a salmon recipe, but this is like my go-to thing if I'm like, I want to cook something tonight that is easy, but still healthy-ish or healthy-adjacent. And it's something I really struggled and tried to stay away from for a long time because cooking fish can be kind of difficult and intimidating. We've done walleye. We used to do from Wisconsin and Canada, and breaded walleye is really good, of course. I've grilled salmon before, and that can be kind of on the plank, and that can be difficult. But I have found, since I have an air fryer, that grilling salmon is so simple, and I have no idea why I stayed away from it for so long. And for those of you that have done this before, you're probably nodding along like, this isn't really that good of a recipe, but I'm just going to give it for those folks that are maybe a little scared to cook fish. First of all, if you have an air fryer, great. You can do this in the oven as well. And I always buy the fillets. I go to the Jewel, 63rd and Main in Downers Grove. They got the fillets there for you. Buy a couple of those. And then you wonder, like, how do you season it? What are you going to do? What are you going to put on there? And everyone has their own thing. And there's really no wrong way to do it, except for two things. One, do not leave it in a acidic sort of, what is the word I'm looking for when you're trying to season it ahead of time? Eli, help me out. What did I say?
Could it be a brine?
Marinade. There it is. Duh. Thank you, Eli. And a marinade. Don't leave it in there for too long, especially if you have any acidic juices in there, because those can kind of do funky things to fish, I've heard and learned through trial and error. Are you a salmon guy, Eli? You ever make salmon?
I haven't made it myself, but I love it.
Oh, then pay attention.
My mom makes the best salmon. I'm keen, tuned in right now.
You better be, Eli.
I need this.
It's me and you.
Myself this week.
Mazur and Swanee are gone, so it's me and you, buddy.
I'm here for you.
So salmon, what I do, because I really was like, I don't know how to marinate this thing. You can buy stuff and everything, but I eventually learned that you can just kind of pick out some condiments from the fridge that you already have and put it together. So I do a couple spoons of mayo, little ketchup. Here's one for you that is going to take a little twist. Maple syrup. Little maple syrup just puts a nice little coating on it. Now, you might be saying, boy, you're adding a lot of terrible things to the fish to make it unhealthy. It doesn't all get on the fish. You know, marinade, how it is. It just kind of like seeps into it.
The aromatics do half the work there.
Exactly. It drips down to the bottom. Little barbecue sauce if you got it too, but not too much because that flavor comes through really hot. I mean, if you want it, so be it. But little barbecue sauce, little ketchup. And I wouldn't go with a yellow mustard, but a nice strong ground mustard. And then, of course, some olive oil. Mix that together about 15 minutes before you put the fish in the air fryer. You do it in the oven. You can grill this thing, too. But I've always found that you better get the plank or something to do it on. Otherwise, it's just going to break apart and fall into the grill. Do it without any skin on it. So buy those fillets that are already skinless. Some people like to have the skin on it, and then they peel it off when they flip it. That's too much for me. So if you just want something really simple, I mean, you could just call it like your condiment potpourri from the fridge, just putting a few things in there. I love the adding the maple syrup has been like kind of my secret to it because it really gives it a nice little kind of burns on there a little bit.
Yeah, like caramelizes a little.
Yeah, a little caramelizes. Yeah, exactly. Boy, that sounded like an official term.
Yeah, my stomach's rumbling now.
Yeah, boy, there you go. Well, you get yourself some maple syrup salmon.
I will go
with some ketchup and mayo. Is this the grossest thing that Dean's show has ever been suggested? I think it's really good. The only reason I just suggested it is because I have stayed away so much from fish my whole life, and I just wish I had known how easy it was to do this with salmon. So 312-981-7200, the 224 chimes, and I'm grilling Wild Alaskan Copper River salmon tonight. Well, I bet the 224 has a better recipe than I do. But I'm curious, 224, and anyone else out there that wants to help, if you got any other quick or easy little recipes for people to have to enjoy. Because I tell you what, that air fryer is a game. Do you have an air fryer, Eli?
I just moved apartment, so I haven't brought my air fryer with me. It's in storage, but I'll have to get it back out.
You have an air fryer in storage? Yeah, get it on out of there. So easy. Grilled chicken has changed my life doing that. So easy. And I know there's a lot of cooks here that listen, and they're like, this is the most basic stuff. But trust me, some of us are not born great chefs and cooks. Both of my brothers are firefighters, so they cook for everyone in their firehouse. So they've got this down. And I'm just trying to learn a little bit more as we make more and more dinners at home. But my, oh my, that's salmon recipe. So yeah, just go through your condiment drawer and put it all on there and figure it out. I also make a really good lasagna as well. Really simple. I buy the oven prepared. I know this is going to freak a lot of Italians out, but I buy the oven prepared lasagna sheets that are already ready, the flat ones in the blue box. And what's really key is just a really good mix of the ricotta cheese. Just put an egg in there, and I overdo it a little on the parsley. That really gives it an extra kick. And the sauce that I make, I started as a roux, where I put together a lot of finely chopped carrots, celery, onions, red pepper. I mean, I try and chop them as small as you can. Use a food processor if you want. Get a little roux going. Fire those up in some olive oil. Maybe put a little flour in it to thicken it up a little bit before you put in the sauce. And you put those layers together with mozzarella, those pre-made lasagna things. Boy, you are great. 6-year-old says, I have the easiest and the best salmon recipe to add to your collection. I just got to Google Barefoot Contessa's seared salmon with red pepper aioli. That's a tough word. It's easiest and totally foolproof. Well, I'll try that out. We're out of time, though, here today. I appreciate you guys letting me share these 4 hours here in for Dean. I appreciate that. We'll be on tomorrow night, Your Money Matters, at 6 o'clock.